It's Tuesday, December 13th, 2016, and we have a full agenda today. It will probably take the entire 2 hours or so that we have scheduled, or 3 hours. 3 hours. And so just to let people know, order of business, the first thing we're going to do is have some informational meetings, some presentations on some concepts, and then we're going to introduce some committee bills, because we'll have a quorum here to do that. There, committee bills are bills that have been asked to be developed by the committee, and we have like 24 of them, so it'll take a few minutes to get that done. And then we have some other, I think, great informational stuff to and give us some more information. So to begin with, I am going to open an informational meeting and have a presentation on education-related concepts by members of the State of the Senate. So with that, President Courtney, would you like to come forward and give us the testimony on a couple of the concepts that you are having? And you can bring whoever you want with you. Did you want Libby to be up there with you? Is that what
I want as many people as I can. I want everybody. She should yell. Is this everything? Or just, Your Honor, excuse me, my name is Peter Corson.
You have the opportunity to talk about any of the bills that you have, LC 3083, which has to do with merger of community colleges and public universities, and LC 1175, which has to do with PE in schools. And I know that you had a work group that worked on that during the interim.
Okay. This is State Senator Peter Courtney. I live in Salem. My district, Senate District is 11. I'm a state senator. And thank you, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Canope, who's not here. So I was going to say all the committee, but most of the committee is not here.
No, most of the committee is here.
Those that did come today, thank you for being willing to hear this LC draft involving a concept that I actually experimented with in 2006 with the then president of Western Oregon University, John Minahan. And it is simply a proposal to create a clear path from a community college education to a four-year degree. It allows for a community college and a four-year university to join together to submit a plan to the Higher Education Coordinating Committee to work together to reduce administrative cost. Our one president instead of two, one provost instead of two, one human resource director instead of two, one legal department instead of two, one dean of students, actually they're now called vice president of student affairs instead of two. I'd say one athletic director, but I know the power of athletics instead of two, but I'll say it anyway because it would be probably of all of these, that would be the fiercest battle that they'd have, only one director of athletics in terms of the what hopefully would be a merger with a community college and a four-year institution. Now, as partners, a community college and university can offer a non-traditional route to a degree for students, Oregon students, especially some of those, many of those who are in financial need. 6 in 10 Oregon college graduates, when they come out, as you well know, are in debt some $26,000. I actually think that figure is inaccurate. I think it's very low, given the 30 years I was at Western Oregon University. I don't know where they came up with some of these figures. They used to take $24,000, then I think they simply they increased to $2,000 every year. But I do think $26,000, I'm talking about the four-year institutions in Oregon and the public, I think $26,000 is a low figure for the total debt, at least the many of the students that I was familiar with at Western Oregon University. The prospects of that amount of debt scares many students who shy away from four-year university experience, at least was true in my Senate district in terms of my different high schools and students. The average cost of in-state tuition for full-time students, which is often a figure used, as you well know, is $8,503, compared to $5,455 at community college. Additionally, students at community colleges often live at home, a savings and average cost of $9,350 per room and board, a figure that I often never hear mentioned. I always hear the tuition cost. But room and board is a big factor and a big cost in these schools. Now, even without the promise, students can save more than $6,000 in tuition and $18,000 in room and board by choosing a community college for their first 2 years of post-secondary education. Transferring from community colleges to a four-year university, however, can be a daunting thing for many students. by allowing an administrative merger between a community college and four-year university. LC 3038 would reduce the transitional challenge. As partners, the two universities could guarantee a curricular continuity that would assure students that their community college credits would count towards their four-year degree. I could go on. This testimony was prepared for me. I they've used the word partners. I don't want to call this a hybrid or crossover. I am truly interested in some kind of if it would ever be done. This is not a mandatory bill. This is not mandatory. I'm smarter than that. This is simply an enabling piece of legislation that would allow the respective boards now that govern our 17 community colleges and our 7 public universities to take a good look at this and decide if they wanted to try it. I actually was very interested in it in 2006. It was personalities that got in the way of us having further discussions. We were involved, very close discussions, with a certain community college, Western Oregon, its counterpart. But then the powers of egos got involved, and we couldn't get there. And it would have been very daring if we tried it. It was even on we even actually started an LC draft and walked away from it way back in 2006. So I realize I'm before a committee of individuals who are very learned in all education matters, and you are think about things way ahead of most of us. So I'm not prepared to go into all the details of the administrative structure, but the bottom line is to try to lower the cost for students. Number two, to make sure students who don't live traditional lives, I'm not going to tell you what that means, you know what I mean, and see this as much more daunting and threatening as a way to actually say, I can actually get a degree one day because of this new structure that's been created in the great state of Oregon, my Oregon. So that's why I've started this conversation. I don't like to talk that way. I don't believe in these cool statements. I'll just have a conversation. I'm serious about the bill. I'm serious about this committee. And so I'm coming before you in this interim and to ask you to at least look at this, consider introducing a committee bill. And my learned and high Supreme Counsel who drafted the bill according to what he wanted, not what I wanted, but he went to the University of Chicago, so I defer to him, because you said you cannot do all you wanted to do. So as usual, LC, I was going to say trumped me, but you can't say that anymore, overruled me. And so if you have any clever, cute questions about Peter, let me ask you. I'm going this way, right here, and that's why he is here.
So is there any questions about this LC draft?
Yes.
Senator Hess.
No, here it
thank
goes.
You, Mr. Chairman. Mr. President, thank you for, I think this is a good place to explore to see if we can bring down costs and see if we can continue to keep pushing on this to make it more affordable. And it seems like a pretty logical place to look at. And I don't know if we can get the mechanics right, but I think there are people who understand what needs to happen and how that will work. But I do remember a few years ago, Southern Oregon was going through a really difficult time. They went through a legal process of entrenchment. They're cutting programs. And at the very same time, Rogue Community College was thriving. They're bursting at the seams, adding programs. And it just seems reasonable to me that they could partner and take advantage of the good things that are happening at one, the good things that are happening at the other. So it seems like a pretty logical next place to go as we keep trying to figure out how to get our kids into college at a place that families can afford, because there's really not too many alternatives without any kind of post-secondary education. So thanks for your work on this, and hopefully we can work together and get something out in this session on this point.
Senator Beyer.
I too, Senator Courtney, think this is a good idea to explore. I'm curious when you were, and I guess I look to the draft, when you're drafting this, what would be, I guess I could see administrative savings, but what would be the difference from a student perspective between some of the programs where they have dual enrollment now, where someone who starts in Mount Hood at the same time is enrolled as a PSU student. So they have the dual enrollments, and so all of their credits automatically transfer when they, I guess, hit junior status.
Trevor Oatland, Senator Beyer. It's
There would need to be details with any particular merger that would have to be worked out. But I would say that one of the potential differences is that they could continue to stay at the community college for all 4 years instead of actually having to transfer, and that the savings in cost that President Courtney was speaking about with respect to the living expenses and just actually the cost of actually moving to where the 4-year university is.
Interesting.
Thank you. That obviously, Mr. Chair, yes, this is he's actually the dynamic of this is now hopefully before you as to what we're trying to do. It's a whole new way of thinking. You have to do that. Otherwise, it won't function, because we are always thinking, how do we transfer these credits and everything? I want all that gone. You don't even think of that. You're in this institution, and the sky's the limit in terms of how far you want to go. Without stopping or in any way taking away from the incredible programs that community college offer now in terms of the trades and things. So the magnitude of this is there. The athletic programs, I have no intention to attack those. Community colleges have athletic programs, and they drop football. But they're very competitive in the other areas, volleyball and women's basketball, men and women's basketball and volleyball. And I'm not trying to take away from the four-year institutions, higher athletic programs either, because I am well aware of that. But I do think there should be a merger even there, at least in terms of the administrative structure, Senator Beyer, in terms of an athletic director, one athletic director and things. Hopefully some of that cost savings then would move on to the students in terms of less cost and things. This room and board thing is, I cannot tell you how big a cost it is, and we continually forget that. We always go to tuition, then occasionally we run to fees, but room and board is very, very expensive, and it really gets in the way of a lot of the students that I'm familiar with in my district and I think across the state, and it gets into their mental thinking. They just, you know, I can't get there. Well, I guess I'll start here. And this thing, if we can do it, by the way, I don't think it should be just looked at in terms of the TRUES. They call them the TRUES now. You know what the TRUES are, the four smaller universities. I'm not so sure that Portland State shouldn't really look at this in terms of PCC, because PCC is as dynamic a community college, I think, as anywhere in the country in terms of all its campuses. So I think Portland State should also look at this. Now, I don't expect U of O, OSU, for reasons I won't go into, and look at it, but I'm not so sure that at least one of the big three should look at this as well. Just my thought, and you may totally disagree with this collectively and individually, but I really wish, 2006, man, I was tempted to make a run at this thing, and I still wonder what would have happened if we'd ever tried it. Because you're right. Often a community college is really exploding and doing very well, and one of your smaller four universities are struggling. They're struggling in a lot of ways, and yet they're needed, because many of the students that go to, as I say, to Western Oregon, if you don't have a Western Oregon, they're never going to get a bachelor's degree, if you know what I'm saying. Whereas the students, no disrespect, that go to Willamette across the street, those students, if there's not a Willamette, they're going to get a four-year degree somewhere, if you understand the points I'm making here. So we need these smaller universities. And, of course, we have a dynamic 17 different community colleges which cover the state. I see no reason why we shouldn't at least maybe look at some of this merger, if you will. So thank you. I appreciate it very much. You got a huge agenda, and you don't need me talking anymore.
I just want to say, would both the community college portion of this arrangement and the higher ed or the university or college, would they both have their own independent boards? Because there's different relationships between...
You know, I'm twitching now. You're bringing up a subject I feel only too strongly about in the past. I'm not prepared to comment on that. Okay. I think the two boards, Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, respectfully, the two boards are going to have to make the decision to at least come together, even though I talk about the heck. They've got to decide this because of what we've done with this structure in the state regarding governance in higher education. Thank you. So there are going to be players in this, and I'm not prepared to answer that, but I'm not so sure that maybe this legislation shouldn't get into it. I did not choose to do it here. This is tough enough stuff to start out with, but I have a feeling that maybe you're going to have to go there eventually, to be very frank with you. But I wasn't going to put that in this bill.
Okay. Any other questions on this legislative concept? Senator Courtney, our second legislative counsel.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Learned and High Counsel. Thank you. You are supreme.
Admissions.
I'd love to have a great lawyer.
Taxes.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Knopf, members of the Senate Education Committee. 10 years ago, the legislature passed a major bill, House Bill 3141. The bill passed both chambers with overwhelming support. There was only 2 no votes in the House and 1 no vote in the Senate. I will not name the individuals that voted no. The bill had a 10-year implementation timeline. This time has come, and it will take effect on July 1, 2001. Now, on July 1 next year, elementary schools, K-12, will be required to provide a minimum of 150 minutes of physical education. Middle schools have to provide 225 minutes of physical education, and at least 50% of physical education minutes must be spent in physical activity. There are about 20 states that have some sort of law about PE. It is just as important as any other subject, and according to updated federal education laws, is part of a well-rounded education. Regular physical activity is good for our kids. Too many of our children aren't getting enough exercise. We have to get our kids moving. It was a problem 10 years ago, and it's still a problem today. Studies show that regular physical activity at school benefits children's academic performance. Kids who are active have higher test scores and grades. They pay better attention to academic tasks. They have better memory and recall. Active children are even less likely to act out in school. Unfortunately, a recent study showed that less than 10% of Oregon schools are meeting the standards. Those who don't meet the standards next year will be in violation of this law. This concept was put together by my office, which worked with school boards, superintendents, teachers, and healthcare advocates to make sure schools can and will comply with the law beginning next year. It is a technical fix, this bill, to take the original bill that will help the Department of Education create rules so schools can have the flexibility to prorate minutes for weeks that may include holidays, inclement weather, or other out-of-school activities. Research determining the appropriate number of minutes hasn't changed in 10 years. We adults must make the health of our children a priority. If we don't do something about our kids being inactive, they will be too tired, too sick, and too inactive to read or write or do math. Years ago, I said the only thing wrong with kids is adults. It was true then, it's true now. Surely there is a way to provide 30 or 45 minutes a day to make our kids healthier, happier, better students, and better citizens than the famous saying that the nuns gave me years ago in Latin, which I'm not going to give you in Latin because I'm not as good at Latin as I once was, not that I ever was that good. Healthy body, a healthy mind, a healthy mind, a healthy body. So that is what is before you. It's a measure that I've been dealing with for 10 years and that we overwhelmingly passed 10 years ago, as they say, with 3 dissenting votes totally, House and Senate.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Bearsugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney, why do you think what do you think is the reason that we haven't made, you know, good progress in this in the last 10 years?
Well, Chair Bowman, Senator Bertschinger, you'd have to ask the individual school boards. I think we do not in our society emphasize, in general, physical activity the way we should. In our activity with our children all across the boards, I don't think we value physical activity or movement to the extent we could. So I think it starts there overall, and that is something that's outside the schools. It's the responsibility of all. So it would start there. Then you get into a situation where we got into trouble because of the cuts to schools and things that school boards made decisions. They made decisions on the basis of what they thought were the most important things, which is reading, writing, and doing arithmetic. Physical education was not considered a priority. And I don't think we've ever made that decision in the way we address education K through 12 in this state. I'm not sure we've ever said, ever, it is as important, I said it in my testimony, as I was reading, writing, everything. We've never said that. That has never been our view. And so I think that is my opinion, having not served on a school board or been a teacher, two extraordinarily difficult tasks, and I can understand why those decisions were made. So that is the best I can do with your question.
So,
yes.
As a son of a physical education teacher, my dad taught physical education for over 35 years, middle school and high school. We just had the same exact conversation on Sunday. So, anything I can do to help you push this forward, I would most likely be very interested in doing.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Senator Hatz.
Thank you. There was some schools have been doing this full time with or without the requirement, and one of them that's done a really good job is Summit in Bend, Summit High School, and they use the words conditioning synonymously with physical education, and the difference is less dodgeball, more running the mile, and conditioning gets you to a higher level of fitness than some of the traditional PE, that it's still valuable too. And I was just wondering if you had thought about that, or if that enters into the equation somewhere, if we're trying to get them physical education as much as we are trying to get them fit. And there is a subtle distinction there, and if you've given any thought to that.
Chair of Oldham, Senator Hatz, I have not thought of using different words to describe something, except in my own case. And when I'm asked, are you trying to get in shape, Peter, when people see me at the Y and they're laughing. And I always say, no, I'm not trying to get in shape. I'm in training. I use the phrase in training. I don't like to say I'm getting in shape for Hood to Coast. I don't like to say I'm getting in shape. At my age, you try to get in shape. You don't say you should try to get. I say I'm in training because I love to tell people I'm in training. I don't know why. That appeals to me. So as soon as you said what you said, I jerked back and personalized it, if you understand what I'm saying. Because I do think everything's in a word. Everything's in a phrase. Humans think like that. And you can change a whole attitude. The whole attitude by how you talk, to be very frank with you, in the whole area. And maybe by changing a word or two, we'd make it more attractive or it seemed to be more important. I don't know that because I think that's what you're asking me. But I like to say, just in terms of, I'm in training. That means so much more than you're getting in shape or you're working out. No, I'm not working out. I just did a spinning class. No, I'm not working out. I'm in training. I think that makes me man, makes me manly. Now, look at this. This is pathetic. Look at this thing. This is, you're not going to do anything. I get that. But by saying I'm in training, it motivates me. You know what I'm saying? So I'm trying to relate that to what you're saying because I think that's what you're saying.
I think we should look at what Summit has done, and I think there are some benefits today that weren't there maybe 10 years ago, much less 20 or 30 years ago. That if we can get to getting kids more physically fit, as opposed to educated about physical education in the old traditional sense, I think we get closer to the reason that you want to do this in the first place. The reason we all want to do this is because when kids are fit, they're healthy, you know, all kinds of good things happen. The brains work better, they need less health care, and you know, attitudes improve and all of those things. But I think there's a way to sort of update physical education from what it was back in the 60s, 70s when I was a kid.
Thank you. And my only comment is that I appreciate the update of the bill from 10 years ago. We had a lot of districts that were out there nervous about the prescriptiveness of the old way, and this one actually gives them a lot more flexibility. So if they're in a four-day week that some of our schools are in, and if they have other kinds of issues, this is about minutes and hours, and they can adjust to meet those requirements. I think that's an important part of what we're doing here. So thank you for that. Any other questions for Senator Courtney? Seeing none,
thank you very much.
And we're going to close our informational meeting and presentations of related concepts. And we're going to open a work session on the introduction of committee measures. And just so people know, we have 24 of them. We will read through all of them because we have to, and then we will vote on them in block. And so people in the audience know and other people on the table know, voting for these does not indicate whether you like them, dislike them, or are totally opposed to them. It only indicates that we are putting them into the system so that they can be pre-session filed as committee bills. We don't even know whether these bills will come back to this committee or not. So stay tuned if you're interested in any one of the ones that we're introducing. Watch where they get sent after we have our first opening ceremonies in February, because things change as time goes on. But we were given these, and my intention is to introduce them today with the understanding that they're introduced, and the people who are interested in them or whatever can talk to their committee chairs where they end up and decide whether or not they're going to move forward. So with that, I'll read through them first, and we'll be asking our good Senator Canope to make the motion.
Want me to do that now?
Yes.
This is my punishment for being late. So
right.
There's 24 of them. We'll see how we do. Chair Roblin, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee measures. LC 913, dated 10-3-16. LC 1000, dated 9-30-16. LC 1073, dated 11-22-16. LC 1151, dated 11-8-16. LC 1152, dated 12-5-16. LC 1153, dated 9-12-16. LC 1222 dated 9-12-16. LC 1229 dated 9-27-16. LC 1255 dated 10-25-16. LC 1277 dated 11-8-16. LC 1375 dated 10-5-16. LC 1379 dated 9-26-16. LC 1380 dated 10-7-16. LC 1381 dated 10-24-16. LC 1410 dated 10-7-16. LC 1643 dated 11-8-16. LC 1655 dated 10-3-16. LC 1704 dated 10-5-16. LC 1794 dated 11-16-16. LC 1820 dated 12-6-16. LC 1987 dated 11-9-16. LC 2376 dated 10-20-16. LC 2451 dated 12-9-16. And LC 2453 dated 12-9-16.
Thank you, Senator Canope. Any discussion? Seeing none, as moved by Senator Canope, these 24 LC drafts, I'm not going to read them again, anyone opposed to introducing these as committee bills with the understanding that voting for this does not indicate support or non-support of the bills. Seeing no opposition, the motion passes. Thank you very much. Now, if somebody runs in today and adds a couple more, we'll take care of them at the end because sometimes that happens.
Senator Roblin, no.
So we'll close the work session on LC drafts. Our committee bills. Open an informational meeting on Education Student Succeeds Act by the power presentation and Sarah Shelton and Shamira Mann, if they want to come forward. And thank you for being here from the Institute Education Commission of the States, and we appreciate you coming from Colorado to be here with us. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Shelton, and I'm a member of the State Relations Team at the Education Commission of the States, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk with you about ESSA and the new flexibility that states have. But before I do that, I want to talk briefly about ECS, about who we are, what we do, and how we do it. So ECS, we're the essential, indispensable member of any state team addressing education policy. We're nonpartisan, and we're a member-based organization, and we serve all state education leaders in all 50 states, including Oregon, and this includes legislatures, governor's offices, state departments of education, state departments of higher education, and state school board members. And what do? Well, we really believe in the power of learning from experience because we know informed policymakers create better education policy. So ECS, we serve as a partner to state policymakers by providing nonpartisan, unbiased, personalized support and opportunity for policymakers to come together and learn from one another. And then how do we do this? Well, we divide our work into four buckets around research, reports, counsel, and convene. So research, we compile summaries in 50 state databases on education policies ranging from early childhood to post-secondary education so policymakers can make informed decisions. And last year, we answered over 600 information requests, and we're typically able to turn these around in about 24 hours. And our reports, we regularly issue relevant and timely reports providing education leaders with really concise, factual overviews, again, on the full spectrum of education policies. And I know in your packet of information, you got a copy of our ESSA quick guides, and that's one example of our reports. And in 2016, we issued over 55 reports and databases. In council, we provide unbiased advice on policy plans, we consult on proposed legislation, and we testify at legislative hearings as third-party experts, as we're doing today. And we typically have at least one ECS member out in the states working with policymakers every week. And then finally, we convene. We create opportunities for education leaders to really interact, to collaborate and learn from each other, both within states and across the states. And we do these through policy academies, thinkers meetings, and our national forum. So in our office, we have about 47 individual staff who are really here to serve you, the people behind the policy. And we have really smart, talented researchers and policy analysts who follow legislation on a daily basis and read bills word for word. So please let us know how we can support you as you go into legislative session. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my talented colleague, Sharmila Mann, who directs our K-12 Institute, who will talk about ESSA and the increased flexibility. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Canal, members of the committee, my name is Sharmila Mann. I am the director of the K-12 Institute at the Education Commission of the States, and it is my honor to be here today to talk to you about ESSA. As my colleague mentioned, Education Commission of the States is focused on state-level policymaking, and therefore our work on ESSA has really been around detailing the additional flexibility for states that this law provides and helping state policymakers make sense of that and how they might apply that to their own state context. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act was first passed in 1965, and at its core, it was a civil rights act where it was meant to provide equal access to education for all children. In 2001, we had the last reauthorization prior to ESSA, and that reauthorization was called No Child Left Behind. In that reauthorization, there were many prescriptive federal requirements. In the new reauthorization in 2015, the Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, we see the lifting of a lot of those prescriptive requirements. And because of that, ECS has jumped in and really tried to translate what that flexibility means for states. So my comments are going to be around the new flexibility for states, and I know that later this morning you'll be hearing from Deputy Superintendent Salam Noor about what the Oregon Department of Education is doing to take advantage of that flexibility. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over the next two slides, which are the content there is going to be detailed in the rest of my presentation. In speaking about state flexibility through ESSA, I want to focus my comments on three areas of the law: standards and assessments, accountability, and funding. I focus my comments here because these are the three areas with the largest flexibility provisions for states and the biggest changes from NCLB. I will address standards and assessments separately. Then in accountability, I want to address the flexibility measures, flexibility around measures, which is around the indicators that states use for their accountability system, flexibility around reporting, which is related to state and district report cards that are published by the state, and flexibility around interventions for schools that need support. In the area of funding, I want to talk about the flexibility provisions around supplement, not supplant, and school-based budgeting, both because these are important considerations for state flexibility, but also because we have heard from a lot of our state policymakers that these are areas of great confusion. And I hope to clarify some of that in my comments. As we start with standards, in ESSA, ESSA maintains the requirement that states have challenging academic standards and also that these standards are aligned to college and career readiness. However, there is a lot of flexibility for states in determining their standards that is written into ESSA. In fact, there are many provisions written into ESSA about curtailing the power of the Secretary of Education. Not only are states allowed the authority to set their own standards, the Secretary of Education may not prescribe specific standards, may not provide incentives for or against any certain standards, and the Secretary may not require that the state submit the standards to the Department of Education for approval before implementing those standards. In addition, in the alignment with the college and career readiness, states are allowed to set their own definition of college and career readiness, and they are allowed to define how that alignment is going to happen between their K-12 standards and their college and career readiness definition. In the area of assessments, states are still required to implement annual assessments in English and math in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school, and in science once in each of the grade bands. There is a requirement in the law for 95% participation by all students and all student subgroups, and there is a requirement that this assessment data be disaggregated by subgroups. However, there are many flexibility provisions in the assessments section as well. The one that has been talked about possibly the most is the high school assessment flexibility. That flexibility provision allows districts for the first time to choose their own nationally comparable high school assessment in lieu of the state assessment. In the past, states were able to choose a national assessment, however, they were required to implement that statewide. Now districts are able to choose their own assessments if they are then approved by the state. Secondly, in the past, states have had to use summative assessments, end-of-year assessments, as part of their accountability system. Now there is the option to use interim assessments throughout the year that are rolled up into a summative score as the assessment portion of the accountability system. Computer adaptive assessments are explicitly allowed in the new law, and states may ask the secretary if they can use some of their funds to do an audit of their current assessment system to make sure that it is as efficient and effective as the state would like in accomplishing their education goals. The first part of the accountability flexibility is around the measurements. States must establish a system that meaningfully differentiates their schools. Their indicators, they must have four indicators for every school. The first indicator needs to include proficiency on state assessments and can include growth in high school. The second is a second academic indicator that in high school needs to be the high school graduation rate, and in the other grades may be a growth measure on the state assessment or another academic indicator. The third indicator is the progress of proficiency for English language learners. And the fourth required indicator is a non-academic indicator of the state's choosing. States are required to give substantial weight to every indicator and much greater weight to academic indicators than to the last non-academic indicator. The flexibility here is that in the past, states were not allowed to use growth as well as proficiency in their accountability systems, and they are able to do that now. States can determine the weighting of every one of their indicators as well as the measures that go into each of those indicators, with the one caveat that academic indicators must as a whole have much greater weight than non-academic indicators. And finally, the states are allowed to choose their own non-academic indicator as a measure of school quality and student success. This can include measures of student engagement, such as chronic absenteeism, educator engagement, and advanced student education opportunities such as dual enrollment or college readiness measures. The second area of accountability flexibility comes in reporting. States must still prepare and disseminate a report card at the district and at the state level each year that includes a description of the state's accountability system, results on the indicators that we just discussed, participation rates, and some form of weight on the participation rates for districts that do not meet the 95% criteria, the professional qualifications of educators, per pupil expenditures by source, whether it's federal, state, or local, and the National Assessment of Education Progress, or NAEP results, which were not previously required. The two areas of flexibility in reporting are, first of all, the subgroup size, and while there are current federal regulations that set that N at 30 or higher, the law itself does not set an N size for the states. And therefore, as we go with the letter of the law, the states may set their own N size for their subgroups. In addition, states are no longer required to provide one single summative rating for each of their schools. They instead may have a dashboard that has much more nuanced information. There is the requirement that they are able to differentiate the lowest 5% of Title I schools. In the intervention flexibility, there is a requirement that the states establish ambitious state-designed long-term goals and identify schools for intervention that do not meet those goals. There are two types of schools that need to be identified for intervention: comprehensive support schools and targeted support schools. Comprehensive support schools are that 5% of Title I schools that are the lowest performing, or any high school, Title I or non-Title I, that graduate less than two-thirds of their students annually. The targeted support schools are those schools that have consistently underperforming subgroups. States are also required to use evidence-based interventions, though the specificities of evidence-based are not included in the law. The flexibility in interventions are, first of all, that in the NCLB reauthorization, there were very prescribed school turnaround models. In ESSA, there are no prescribed school turnaround models, and states may approve the models that work best for their districts. Districts are responsible for developing the models, or states are for comprehensive support schools, and states are responsible for approving them. Finally, the funding flexibility. I wanted to clarify what supplement not supplant really means for states, as well as what school-based budgeting means. In supplement not supplant, in the past, federal funds were not allowed to be used for anything that state and local funds were also being used for. That is no longer true. Now there is a requirement that states must meet about the distribution of state and local funds so that they are equitable across Title I and non-Title I schools within a district. If the state meets that requirement, the federal funds may be used in any way to support at-risk students. A new requirement in ESSA is that states must account for expenditures at the school level. In many cases, states have been accounting for expenditures at the district level, so this will require that new procedures and data collection is put into place at the district level that will allow expenditures to be broken out at the school level. These expenditures must include both personnel and non-personnel costs. There is some flexibility associated with this provision, however. Given that states will provide school level expenditure information. States can also provide schools with Title I waivers. And what Title I waivers allow schools to do is that not only can they use those funds, as I mentioned before, on any allowable activity for at-risk students, they can use those funds for any allowable activities for all students in the school that benefit the student achievement across that school. In addition here, I wanted to mention that Title IV now provides a consolidated grant to states in lieu of many, many specialized programs. And that consolidated grant allows a lot more flexibility for state spending. There are requirements around that state grant a well-rounded education, safe and healthy schools, and support for effective use of technology are all addressed through that grant money. I'll finish with a few strategic considerations I'd like to highlight. First, at ECS, we have consistently been recommending to states that the best way to use this flexibility is to develop a state vision for what you would like Oregon's school system to do and how you would like it to serve your students. Allowing that vision to be developed first allows you to allocate funds and to drive your flexibility in a direction that serves your vision. I know that later today, Deputy Superintendent Noor will speak to the significant efforts that the Oregon Department of Education has made in terms of getting stakeholder engagement to create this vision for Oregon schools. Secondly, I'd like to mention that it is important to pay attention to the purpose of your accountability system. Accountability systems can be used in many different ways. It can be used for systems change. It can be used to improve local school districts. It can be used as a hammer, and it can be used as something to provide encouragement to students and teachers. It is important for a state to figure out which way they want to use their accountability system before they design that system, because everything that is measured does not need to be reported. Those things that are reported go into the hard accountability system. Other things that are measured can be used for school improvement. Finally, I leave you with the consideration that ESEA was originally developed in the civil rights spirit that all students have equal opportunity to an effective education, and I would encourage you to keep that in mind as you develop the ways that you will apply the new state flexibility of ESSA. Thank you.
So, any questions for our panel? I do want to reiterate that in the time I've been in the legislature the last 12 years, the Commission on States has been a valuable asset to us, and we, and each and every member here, as well as each and every member in the legislature, has the opportunity to select, to have a research question or anything they want to know and get more information about, to submit stuff to them, and the turnaround is really very quick. And I know that our administrators are now analysts at the in our state capital, use that a lot. But individual members have, too, for a long time. And I would encourage members here and other members in the legislature, if you have a question at some point and you don't feel like you're getting the answers that you would like, this is a great nonpartisan group to go to. Send off your questions and wait for your return, because it'll come back fairly quickly. And for those of you who are sitting in the audience, if you have legislators you work with and you have something that comes up and a question, you can always encourage them to send a question off to the group from the states and have them get your information back for you. So we need to use the resources that we have available to us, and this is one of those assets that I hope all legislators will use. And for me, thank you very much for simplifying it. The bill is longer than that. And so having tried and attempted, it's a great piece of legislation for going to sleep, but it's not really easy to understand all of the intricacies. So I really do appreciate this simpler definition. So any other questions? Nope. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Here we go, right? So we're going to close our informational meeting. We're going to do an update from ODE on a number of different bills we passed last session. So the first one of our invited speakers will be the dyslexia education, Emily Nazaro and Carrie Thomas Beck. If you want to come on up. Thank you, both of you.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Knope, members of the committee. My name is Emily Nazarov, and I'm one of the legislative coordinators at the Oregon Department of Education. When you passed Senate Bill 612 in 2015, you created a position at the department for a dyslexia specialist. And so I brought Carrie Thomas-Beck, our dyslexia specialist, to give you an update on the work she's been doing to implement Senate Bill 612.
Thanks. So my name is Carrie Thomas-Beck, and I am the dyslexia specialist from the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm here to provide an update on our progress with the dyslexia work to date. As a quick reminder, I wanted to go through the requirements of Senate Bill 612, specific to the plan for universal screening for risk factors of dyslexia. Senate Bill 612 requires the Department of Education to develop a plan to do two things. One is to ensure that every student who is first enrolled at a public school in this state for kindergarten or first grade receives a screening for risk factors of dyslexia. Two, that the plan provide guidance for notifications sent by school districts to parents of students who are identified as being at risk for dyslexia based on the screening for risk factors. According to the Senate bill, the plan must be developed collaboratively with experts on dyslexia, including representatives of nonprofit entities who have expertise in issues related to dyslexia, and the dyslexia specialist from the department. That the plan identify screening tests that are cost-effective for districts, and the plan identify screening tests that screen in four areas: phonological awareness, rapid naming, letter sound correspondences, and family history of reading difficulties. In March of 2016, the Oregon Dyslexia Advisory Council was formed. This council, consisting of stakeholders from across the state, met quarterly beginning in March of 2016 through September to develop this plan. ODAC also reached out to experts on dyslexia and reading instruction in the field to seek guidance in finalizing the recommendations in this plan. These experts included Dr. Jack Fletcher from the University of Houston, Dr. Louisa Motes, a widely acclaimed researcher, speaker, author, consultant, and trainer, Dr. Patricia Mathis of Southern Methodist University, and Drs. Ed Kamehanui and Hank Fien from the University of Oregon. The plan was drafted and submitted to the Interim Legislative Committees on Education on September 6th of this year. And just to provide a few highlights in that plan, first, that universal screening is defined as a multi-step process. Universal screening for a family history of reading difficulties will be completed in the form of a brief written questionnaire as part of the kindergarten enrollment process. That's the current recommendation. Initial universal screening of kindergarten students in the other three required areas will be completed in the fall, winter, and spring, and in the fall for grade one. Because the screening tools that are required in the Senate bill provide the greatest predictions of risk only through the fall of first grade, the plan does not recommend that districts be required to continue screening in winter and spring of first grade. Beginning winter of first grade, the measures that provide the best predictions of risk of reading difficulties change to include word reading and oral reading fluency. The department has established criteria for districts to select screening tools in this plan. Systems for universal screening must have strong predictive validity, classification accuracy, and include norm reference scoring. The measures must include tools for all the risk factors required in Senate bill, phonological awareness, letter sound correspondences, rapid naming, at least once per year. And these universal screening systems must include progress monitoring measures that are connected to the universal screening tools. The recommendation is that the department will provide a list of approved screening measures that meet this criteria to districts. Districts will select one of the approved screening systems and administer the subtests in each of the areas at designated points in time based on test developer guidelines. And that a district may apply to select an alternative screening system that meets the criteria. The proposed structure for notifying parents and guardians of those children who are at risk for reading difficulties based on the screening is consistent with the guidelines from the Department of Education for districts in Oregon who are implementing a response to intervention model. The plan recommends that districts use multi-tiered systems of support in the context of general education to serve students who demonstrate risk factors for reading difficulties, including dyslexia. The tiered support will be provided daily, be aligned with the International Dyslexia Association's knowledge and practice standards for teachers of reading, be systematic, explicit, and evidence-based, and be delivered in collaboration with the teacher in each building who has completed the dyslexia-related training. The plan recommends that district monitor progress of students receiving that tiered support and intensify or individualize that intervention if necessary. Students who do not make adequate progress when provided with systematic, explicit, evidence-based instruction that has been implemented with fidelity may be referred to special education. And of course, the special education referral process could begin prior to or at any point in the screening and instructional support system. I wanted to share with you some district feedback that we've received on the plan. A few concerns. So districts expressed concern that the recommendation in the plan for beginning the universal screening process in the 17-18 school year was too aggressive, and they are requesting that the timeline to begin the screening be adjusted to the 18-19 school year. That way, that will ensure that all of the teachers who are designated to complete the dyslexia-related training in each building will have completed that training. Makes sense. Districts interpreted the bill to require screening in kindergarten or first grade to catch those students who were not enrolled in kindergarten. So there have been some requests to adjust the plan to reflect that only first graders who will need to be screened are those who were not screened in kindergarten or who did not attend kindergarten. Districts prefer screening to be defined as a one-time event in kindergarten versus a multi-step process. Districts have expressed that completing universal screening for family history of reading difficulties via a written questionnaire at the time of kindergarten enrollment is problematic and may lead to the collection of inaccurate information. Districts are concerned that the plan currently requires that schools undertake specific prescriptive interventions when a student presents a risk factor on the screening. Districts stress that there is not language in the bill to mandate specific student interventions. The preference from districts is that these recommendations could be included as best practice or technical assistance. Districts have requested guidance regarding how to best serve English language learners when implementing the screening and instructional support recommendations of the plan. And finally, many districts have asked about the possibility of streamlining the assessment process in kindergarten to allow for some type of combined kindergarten readiness assessment and universal screening for risk factors of dyslexia. Based on that feedback, we have a couple of revised recommendations that we would like to make in the plan. One is that we require universal screening beginning in the 18-19 school year and use the 17-18 school year as an opportunity just for interested districts to pilot the recommendations in the plan. Secondly, that we consider collecting information on the family history of reading difficulties as part of an individual problem-solving process only for those students who do not make adequate progress when provided with that tiered support in general education. The information would be collected in person from a parent or guardian as part of the meeting with parents where information is gathered to design a more intensified, individualized intervention. Next steps, Senator Roblin will be introducing new legislation, is my understanding. Once the new legislation has passed, the department will draft the OARs for universal screening, parent notification, and provision of instructional support to take to the State Board of Education for approval. And also during this time period, the department will work on developing additional guidance for districts in the form of a state-level dyslexia handbook.
Any questions? I guess what I would say is that we met just a day or so ago to talk about some of these issues directly and the recommendations with a number of the partners that are making this work. I look forward to having that future meeting and to look at those kinds of things that we need to do from a legislative perspective, actually a legislative fix, as well as things that can be fixed basically in rule when we do that. And I am looking very seriously at the recommendations made by the department. And I really appreciate having a dyslexia specialist who's working with it. I look forward to working with the School Board Association, the teachers, the and all of the other groups who find an interest in this to get it right, because my goal is not to punish people who sometimes think they're being punished, but to make sure that every child who walks into school has the best opportunity to succeed. And we know, those of us who are dyslexic and those of us who have been parents of dyslexic kids, that oftentimes these kids fall through the cracks starting in kindergarten, and they get picked up in special education when they're in fourth or fifth grade because they finally fall behind. And had they had the right interventions and help along the way, we would never have seen them in that system, because they oftentimes have IQs that are above or average or whatever. And it is my belief that most school districts want to do the best for all their kids. So I appreciate the work you've done, because it's been, I know it's been difficult, and a lot of meetings have been held with a lot of people to get to where we are. And I will tell you from a person with dyslexia and knowing a lot of parents with it, that parents are really frustrated and they don't want anything to slow down. They just want to get it done and fixed, because they don't want other kids to go through what their families have gone through. School districts need to have the ability to get it done, and getting teachers trained in a short period of time, because the bill required one trained teacher in every school or school district, we need to make sure that they have the opportunity to get that done and to continue to work with them. So I look forward to that. If anybody else is interested in being on any of that kind of stuff as we move forward, please let me know. And that means anybody that's out there on the viewing audience as well. Keep us informed. And again, thank you for the quickly getting a person hired and starting to look at the implementation of this bill over the next few months and years.
And so, Senator Roblin, if I could, I'd like to add that we are also right now in the process of adopting the rules around the teacher training requirements. So that those rules are in the process right now.
Yeah, which is important to have those if you're going to implement before 2017-18. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
And that's all. Thank you for your, yes.
I'm up for the next one.
Okay.
So I'll just stay.
So I don't even have to open it again. The Task Force on School Nursing, Senate Bill 698. Emily's here. Is Mitch? Yeah, there we go. And we'll let you explain.
You can introduce yourself again.
For the record, Emily Nazarov, legislative coordinator with the Department of Education, and I am here to introduce Mitch Kruska, the director of Educational Programs, Secondary Transition, and Alternate Assessment, to give an update on Senate Bill 698 and the School Nurse Task Force.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Mitch Kruska. I am the Director of Educational Programs, as Emily indicated, and I was the Department of Education designee on the Nursing Task Force, and so was involved in that work from the beginning through to the end. And so I'm here today to talk about that. Senate Bill 698 from the 2015 session created the Task Force on School Nursing with the four goals that you see on the slide to support school nursing: examine the healthcare funding streams, recommend new funding streams, recommend standards for school nursing practice, recommend ways to create a coordinated school health services delivery model. The task force completed its work and, based upon that work, submitted a legislatively mandated report in September. The task force identified very early on in its work that there is currently a nursing crisis in the state of Oregon. One example of this is the fact that 79 of 197 districts in Oregon do not provide any school nursing services, and this impacts approximately 29,734 students. As of the 14-15 collection year, the districts that reported, we have identified a current nursing-to-student ratio of one nurse for every 4,664 students in the state. One of the reasons the school nursing situation in Oregon has become a crisis is the increase in chronic health conditions and the need to provide a safe and accessible and learning environment for all students. This list includes just four of the many serious health issues facing schools and school nurses today, and the approximate number of students impacted by each condition. This school nursing shortage has also led to serious problems with school nurses having to delegate more medical procedures to non-medical staff. And this delegation is generally falling to personnel such as office staff and instructional assistants within the school. The task force report contained three specific recommendations for the legislature. First, immediate and sustained funding for underserved districts. Funding would be directed to ODE for necessary infrastructure to support statewide school nursing services. Improve staffing in underserved districts with a sustainability plan as required condition of the districts receiving the funding. Recommendation number two, immediate and sustained funding to implement and maximize school-based Medicaid billing processes throughout the state. These processes would include technical assistance and systems for district to tap into the funding potential of Medicaid and help facilitate implementation of the new free care rule interpretation change in the Medicaid rules. And recommendation number three, a mandated and financially supported Oregon Department of Education, Oregon Health Authority, Public Health Division, interagency work group to develop standards for the practice of nursing in the school setting and create an integrated school health services delivery model. And that was my brief presentation. And I will be happy to take any questions you might have.
So any questions? My long-term goal when I was a high school principal was to acknowledge that Oregon Health Authority and the departments of health really have nurses. They know what to do with nurses. They know how to evaluate nurses. And wouldn't it be nice if we integrated the school nursing program with Oregon Health Authority so that if we have a department of health in your county, you're going to have some nurses. And if we could share costs or whatever, they could hire and work in the schools so we have access to a lot of other things that are out there for kids to make them healthier. So I'm really excited about the final recommendation of the integrated conversations. I hope that that leads to a way where part of the cost of providing nurses in every school will come through our health departments. I just think that makes some sense to me. And then you aren't duplicating services. I know that a school nurse is much different than a health department nurse, but they have certain similarities, and there's things that we could really do that would enhance the opportunity for kids to be able to be seen and taken care of. So I hope this continues to work, and I'll see what I need to do to
very well said, Senator Robert.
So thank you very much for being a part of this. And next we have Education Student Succeeds Act Part 2, brought to us by Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. And hear what our state's doing with all this new flexibility we have.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Oregon Department of Education, and I'm also joined by my colleague, who I will let her introduce herself.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Dawn Huckabee. I'm the Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Teaching, Learning, and Assessment with the Oregon Department of Education.
Mr. Chair, we appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you specific to Oregon's plan that will be submitted to the U.S. Department of Education on the Every Student Succeeds Act. We appreciate the presentation that you received from our colleagues, I hope, from ECS. I hope it was familiar to you based on the presentations we've done in the past. Today, however, we want to share with you some specific points of emphasis that have been recommended by stakeholders from around the state that are likely to go into our plan, and to use this as an opportunity to get some feedback and some input from you regarding that. Given the fact that you have a full agenda and you're pressed for time, I'm going to try and go through these as quickly as I possibly can. Feel free to ask me questions as I do that. What I wanted to do with this slide more than anything is not to go into details about the department's strategic plan, but to underscore what we had shared with you before, that this is an opportunity for Oregonians across the state to reimagine education in the state of Oregon and to let vision drive our priorities and the plan that we submit to the U.S. Department of Education. instead of approaching it exclusively as a compliance or a regulatory activity that we go through. So we started with vision, we started with priorities, and those are the conversations that we had around the state. And speaking of around the state, the yellow dots indicates places where we've been, where we've had very engaging conversations with communities around education and what they value and what they aspire for their students in terms of the hopes, dreams, and the quality of education and the programs and opportunities that they wanted to afford them. The pink dot indicates places that we are going to go to circle back and share what we've learned from our work groups, what we've learned from the community conversations that we've had, and to get additional feedback and input into the process. Again, we stage this based on visioning, based on reimagining education, and what's best for students and what's best for Oregon schools and educators as well. As we think about the Every Student Succeeds Act, you learned from our colleagues from ECS that this is really a civil rights law. It's a law that is founded on equity, and it's really designed to serve the needs of specific students, to supplement the education that we as states provide for those students, such as migrant students, English learners, students that are navigating poverty. It's also about providing academic enrichment and support activities through school, before school, after school, and supporting our homeless students. We see this as an opportunity, in addition to serving those students and making sure that their educational needs are met, is to really think about our system in terms of standards and assessment, accountability, and school and district improvement, and educator effectiveness. So our colleagues, I believe, ended their presentation with a slide on state vision, systems change, and civil rights. We believe that the work that we have done really encompasses all these three principles. So it's an opportunity to think about what we want to do, how we want to do it, and most importantly, why we are doing it. So as we engaged in these conversations and as we've done some great deal of reflection and analysis and synthesis of the information that we have gathered so far, we've asked ourselves, what does this law really mean for students? And we've heard this very clearly and soundly from all of the participants in these community forums, but from students specifically. And I had the opportunity to engage about 30 students yesterday from student councils from around the state, and they reaffirmed and confirmed all of these things that I'm sharing with you today. So for students, this really means a well-rounded, comprehensive education that provides equitable opportunities for students to access a wide range of curriculum, wide range of programs and opportunities. So instead of going through these one by one, it provides access to English and math and reading and social studies and health and PE and music and all kinds of enrichment activities. Career and technical education is on the list. So we heard from Oregonians that they want their children's education to be comprehensive and provide access to all of these wonderful opportunities. We also thought about, what does this mean for teachers? The flexibility that's been afforded to us under the law provides access to professional development resources that were restrictive under No Child Left Behind. Title IIA was almost exclusively used for math and reading and science. And now these resources are available for all teachers to access to continue their own professional development and growth. So districts have some flexibility to take advantage here. For teachers, it also means that test scores are now optional as part of a teacher evaluation. We're leaving that up to schools and districts to decide if they want to maintain that. The work that we have done honors and maintains Senate Bill 290 and the evaluation framework that was established by Senate Bill 290. But the federal requirement that student test scores be tied to teacher evaluations has been relaxed. So that is some flexibility that's afforded to schools and districts. Testing is maintained, as you heard, in grades 3 through 8 and in high school in math and reading, and once in science at every grade span, elementary, middle, and high. For school districts, this is an opportunity to think about the information that we gather and provide to parents and communities. So this is a mock-up report card, and I'll be able to speak to it more specifically here in a couple of minutes. But the idea is that we will have a report card that contains a lot more information and data that is really meaningful and relevant for parents and communities in general, and that school districts will be able to share successes and not just focus on the challenges that they typically face. For communities, and forgive me, I'm rushing through this in the interest of time, I think for communities, and this is essentially what we've tried to model through these community forums and conversations, is that communities need to be at the table in designing programs and designing the education that we want to afford students. And this includes teachers, parents, students, and a variety of other partners that are integral to this process. So this really reinstates the emphasis on partnership and collaboration and designing programs and systems that really meet the needs of the community that those students reside in. So this gives you a general framework in terms of how we approach this plan. Now I'm going to get into some of the specifics that will be included in our plan, and there is yet a lot of work to do in this process, but at least this begins to indicate the direction that we are headed as a state. So in the area of assessment and standards, what we've heard from everyone is that we value as a state, as communities around the state, we value high standards and expectations for all students, and we must not move away from that. We also value flexibility in terms of how we measure student success, and that takes me into the area of assessment. So the flexibility that's been given to us from the U.S. Department of Education under this law is to consider alternate assessments at the high school level, such as nationally normed reference assessment as ACT, SAT, and perhaps others. And we intend to do that. So we're in the process of developing an RFI, a request for information, and this will include participation from school districts and experts around the state to help inform the criteria that will go into that request. And this is an invitation to organizations like ACT, SAT, and others to tell us whether they have an assessment that meets the criteria that we established, meets the requirements that are established by the U.S. Department of Education under this law, and is aligned to our content standards. So we will go through the process to select an assessment or multiple assessments, and think the question that we're grappling with is, do we have the capacity to manage multiple assessments? Do we have the ability to afford multiple assessments? What we are committed to is identifying assessments that meet the needs of our state and truly tell us how our students are performing on content standards. So that is flexibility that we intend to take here, to take advantage of. ECS also shared with you a provision in the law that allows for interim assessments in lieu of a summative assessment. We intend to pilot that with our science assessment, and I want to underscore the fact that this work is really intensive. It takes time to develop. It's not something that we will do in the short term, but we intend to establish a process to get us there. But under the science assessment, we intend to look at interim assessments that also have to go through the approval process with the U.S. Department of Education in lieu of a summative assessment. So if an Oregon student takes those assessments, let's say hypothetically speaking there are three of them, and they perform well on those assessments, they're calibrated to the summative assessment, and they have a commensurate score, then they don't need to take the summative assessment. And if we're successful in that regard, we can definitely look at reading and math as well. Okay. In the area of accountability and reporting, what we propose, which is flexibility that's been afforded to us under the law, is to not have a single overall summative rating of schools, and rather to use a multiple measure dashboard that provides a lot more information and provides a continuum of progress, if you will. And in that dashboard, which I will show you a mock-up of here, you will have a lot of information that becomes more meaningful and relevant to communities. It allows for conversations with schools about what do these indicators actually mean, what does progress and growth mean, what does lack of growth mean. So I think we believe that this will provide more meaningful and comprehensive information that addresses three categories: opportunities for students to learn, academic success in college, and career readiness. Some of this information will be used for accountability purposes, and a lot of it could be used just for informational purposes between the school, the district, and the community. Some of the suggested indicators that came out of our work groups fall into multiple categories here, the three that I mentioned, and then they're broken into elementary, middle, and high. Some are more appropriate for elementary schools than they are for high schools. But as you can see, some of the elements are consistent with the values and the priorities that you have declared actually as a legislature and as a committee, such as chronic absenteeism, growth, data aligned to our equitable educator plan. So we've taken a lot of the things that we have worked on here as a state and included them in this plan instead of creating something separate that is designed for compliance and regulations only. This also allows for growth in terms of future indicators that we could add, such as a school climate survey, staff absenteeism, things that the participants told us they would like to know more about. and to understand how they actually affect the quality of the school and the instruction the students are receiving. And this also allows room for schools to list other indicators that are specific to them. So I think it satisfies many, many areas of interest. This is a mock-up report, and as you can see, it has some indicators around chronic absenteeism. It indicates, for example, whether the item has been improved, whether it has stayed the same, whether it has declined, and I think it allows, as I mentioned earlier, for a more substantive, meaningful conversation. One of the questions that you may have relative to accountability, especially if we don't have a single summative indicator or score, how are we going to identify focus and priority schools that we will be calling comprehensive and targeted support schools? We will do so based on these indicators. We will develop a methodology that allows us to identify which schools are the ones that are in need of intensive supports and which are like the comprehensive schools and which are in need of targeted supports. And we're confident that we will be able to have enough information to quantify to be able to identify those schools. So we will continue to identify focus and priority schools. Again, we're calling them comprehensive and targeted support. One of the areas that we've also been given some flexibility in is educator effectiveness, and I'm going to invite my colleague Dawn to talk about that.
Thank you, Salam. And again, Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I just want to give you a little bit of an update of where we are with educator effectiveness. With the waiver process that we were required to have as part of our educator evaluations, a measure that would identify overall educator effectiveness. And that really was a single score that rolled up into a single score. And just as you heard with accountability, we know that educators are more, and just as schools are more than a single score. So we really are looking at how can we make better sense of that, what we mean by an educator that's effective, and want to have a more holistic approach. And so what you see on this slide are some of the ways that we're thinking about that rather than a single score, but really look at what are the four key areas of teaching and how would we then use those four areas as measures to identify an effective educator. With Senate Bill 290 and the framework as Salam discussed, we have an administrative rule that does currently have the rules around the requirement for the state assessments in both teacher and principal evaluations. And so once our plan is approved, we will be looking at changing those, but really still keeping that student learning and student growth as a focus, because it really is critical and vital to the growth of our students. And we are taking this opportunity to utilize our Oregon's Equitable Access to Educators plan, rather than having separate plans, is to combine them and make them more seamless and more transparent. And so using and utilizing some of the strategies that have been identified and articulated in that plan as part of our ESSA plan. And really want to underscore that we're looking here is how do we ensure that our teachers and our building and district leaders are prepared to meet the needs of our culturally and linguistically diverse population, and that they have the responsive pedagogy and practice that they need. Additionally, we have the opportunity to use some of our federal funds to set aside in order to create a stronger pipeline for our teacher leadership and our building leadership, and really thinking about how do we elevate that teacher voice, especially that voice of a teacher who does not want to become a building principal or a district office or district superintendent, and how do we make sure that they have the skill set to continue to lead from within and be able to sustain practices. And so we will be exploring our opportunities with this additional resource to leverage and grow our teacher leaders as well as our building and district leaders.
Thank you, Don. And this is also flexibility that's been afforded to us under the law. In the past, Title IIA teachers can be used only to support teachers and their development and growth. We're taking advantage of the fact that administrators also need to have the opportunity to grow and develop. And I want to underscore the importance of the first two bullets here. They're all important and they're all part of our plan, but it's really important for administrators in particular to understand, to have a deeper understanding of culturally responsive pedagogy and teaching and learning and instruction, because that helps create the environment for their teachers to accommodate students and their learning needs. Also, when we look at school improvement priorities, we want to look at priorities that are focusing on improving instruction for struggling students, particularly students of color, students with disability, English learners, and students experiencing and navigating poverty, if you will. So there is a high level of intentionality in terms of the training and the capacity building that we want to do with administrators and teachers that aspire to become leaders. The next couple of slides go over them really quickly, talk about the time frame, the timeline here. Our work groups have completed their work. They provided the set of recommendations that our advisory committee has reviewed and will continue to review up to the submission of the plan. We're continuing to do stakeholder engagement. We're beginning the initial drafting of the plan. The regulations were finalized in November, and we were delighted to see that because that gives us some clarity and specificity as to how to address some of these requirements. We will continue to do the work up to April when we submit our plan. Currently, we're engaging the State Board of Education in some work sessions and some more detailed work around the plan. The governor will be briefed and will have the opportunity to review and approve the plan as well, and then we will submit to the U.S. Department of Education. Implementation technically is underway. Our waiver ended on August 30th of 2016, so technically we are under ESSA, but officially the implementation begins in 17-18, and we will continue to transition to our accountability system that will take effect in 18-19. And we will also begin the identification of our comprehensive schools in 18 and our targeted schools in 19. So as I indicated, there is much work to be done. At least this begins to frame the direction that we are headed. And I hope we've been able to explain to you that the way we're going to take it, or ways we're going to take advantage of the flexibility that's been given to us. We have a website. We would love to get some feedback from you and others, but we'd love to come and visit with you if you'd like us to and give you more detailed information and get some feedback from you as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and love to answer any questions if you have any for us.
Any questions for Salam? I guess my only one is a more technical one. That has to do with the subgroup populations. Mm-hmm. In the explanation we got, we don't have to use 10 anymore. We can use a number that's described as different. With 10, which is always a problem in small districts,
right.
One person is absent and you've failed the test for that subgroup. Mm-hmm. One person's parent refuses to let them take the test and you've failed the test for that subgroup. Are we going to change the total number of in? I know it will affect smaller schools because less of them will have subgroups, but have we made any decisions or had any conversations about that?
Mm-hmm. Chair Roblin, thank you for your question. We have not made any decisions. I think there will be a lot of technical work that looks at that to determine the impact on the variety of school districts that we have around the state, because you're absolutely right. In some instances, it's one student that can sway that information one way or the other.
Okay.
So, thank you. Appreciate the caution, though.
Thank you. So. Any other questions? Seeing none, thanks again. And you did a very nice job of getting that.
Sorry, I went so fast.
I'm impressed. No, that was good.
We appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
So we're going to close that informational hearing, and we're going to open an informational meeting on the Summer Learning Work Group. And Representative Barbara Smith Warner, you want to come up? And there you are.
Here she is.
There you go. Okay.
Hello, colleagues. Thank you so much for having me. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I'm a state representative from House District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I just wanted to come back today and give you a brief update. I came and spoke to you during September Legislative Days about Summer Slide and the work group that we have been running for the last couple months. Senator Roblin has been to one of the meetings, Representative Jody Hack, Representative Margaret Doherty have also been involved. I don't have a ton to report, but I did just want to give you kind of a little summary. You know about the situation. I do want to read you one of my favorite quotes. I know that you have had Matthew Boulay here, who is such an amazing resource for us to have in state with the National Summer Learning Association. Virtually all of the advantage that wealthy students have over poor students is the result of differences in the way privileged kids learn when they are not in school. America doesn't have a school problem, it has a summer vacation problem. So this is kind of a quote from Malcolm Gladwell that Matthew had in his presentation. And it's one of the things that I think about. The thing I always hang on to when I think about this is the numbers I've seen about the rates, how kids learn when they're in school. And that achievement gap does not exist when they are in school. It is over the summers that it is exacerbated when middle and high income kids continue to have gains and learning gains, and low income kids do not have those, and so they stay the same or go down. So, work group, we had four meetings between May and September of this year. We had a good variety of folks in that meeting, some of the members that I've mentioned, the Department of Education. We had folks from the State Library, from the Oregon Library Association. We had a number of providers present, folks representing Saturday Academy, the Boys and Girls Club, the Y, representatives of teachers and the Oregon Education Association, the School Board Association. Really had a good wide variety of folks attend those. We spent a lot of time talking about the elements of successful summer learning programs. What does that mean? My original goal had been to come out of this with kind of, I had this imaginary chart in my head that we were going to come out with, that when you talk about summer learning, here are the range of things that you were talking about. And here, you know, whether it's, between academic and non-academic, you know, activity wrapped in, all this other stuff. And with the idea of that being kind of a schedule upon which to base how we would, how do we support summer learning in these different kinds of summer learnings. We didn't necessarily get there, because in that conversation we realized that that kind of brought us into a lot of monetizing the value of different kinds of summer learning. And there were so many perspectives represented that the idea that, there are things that are not academic per se, but that truly have significance in learning. The idea of, group sports is a huge learning opportunity, even though it is not academic per se, but do you value that less because it is, while it might not have what you think of as an explicit academic component, you are still, whether it's your strengthening your soft skills, your social interactions, all that stuff. So we ended up moving away from the chart idea, and instead we spent a lot of time talking about some of the things I've talked to you about, making sure the importance of having meals as a part of any summer program, the importance of having it be community-based, that none of us were interested in a one-size-fits-all imprimatur from the state to say this is how you shall do summer learning, but instead we're very interested in having community-specific programs that utilized the providers that were already in those communities providing some of this summer programming, and how do we support and expand that to the best of our ability. So right now I'm working on an LC draft for a pilot program that would establish a non-competitive grant program similar to the way the Ready to Read program is done with libraries and summer reading, that will be administered either through the State Library or the Department of Education. To be eligible, school districts or libraries must work with a community partner to create the program. Funding is our biggest situation. We know that we are going into a session in a biennium where we are going to have a wide variety of funding problems, and the idea of establishing a new program with new funding needs seems like a rather high cliff to scale right now. But I think there is a value in doing a couple things through our legislative concept, which will hopefully then be a bill. To establish a fund within the Treasury, we did a lot of this in the 2015 session, so that there's a designated place for appropriations, even if it's not now. Let's establish the fund there, the place to potentially put outside money. I've seen this done successfully for a number of other programs. You kind of lay the groundwork for future work on this. Oregon Oregon Ask is also putting together a report on specifically on the work group of the progress that we've had, so that we can continue to carry on those conversations and not lose that information that we brought together. And at a minimum, we want to continue the conversation. Even if we don't get anywhere legislatively, we'd like to, we will probably be asking to speak before this committee and the House Education Committee as well, to continue to build momentum and get schools and parents to think about summer in new and innovative ways. And to, you know, our eventual goal is to have us think about learning as a year-round situation, and that that chunk of time, that one quarter of the kids' time when they are not in school, make sure that that is, that there are as many opportunities for as many kids as possible to continue their learning. So, and then the last, just our pilot would be focusing on low-income K-5. We tried to kind of narrow it into a fairly small experimental project so that we can focus on the highest need kids in areas first, and also fully accounting for having food located and working with community partners. That if there was not a community partner to pair with the local library or the school district, it wouldn't happen. So I'll just stop there.
Thank
and
you.
Be brief, as I promised that I would.
Any questions? I just appreciate you pulling together the groups of people that you did, and to work with the assets that Oregon has to try to figure out what to do best for kids. So thank you.
Definitely. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we'll close that information meeting, and we'll open an informational meeting on Task Force on Class Size. Representative Susan McLean.
Nicole
nice to
is going to join me,
that's
if that's
fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us today. Appreciate it. We have a little bit of a PowerPoint, and because I'm a speech teacher, a PowerPoint is not a speech. And so Nicole has offered to handle the PowerPoint while I hopefully am able to speak and communicate with you. First of all, I was honored to be able to be the chair of the Class Size Task Force update, which is coming to you after we passed a bill in 2015 to talk about class size. And as all of you know who have been dealing with education for all these years in your public service, there is not one element that makes for excellence in teaching or an environment that is actually going to create the kind of learning styles and the learning opportunities that we need for a wide variety of students. But one of the elements that has come up over and over again, even if there is 113 different elements to different factions of good, solid teaching and good opportunities for learning, is the size of the class that the instructor is having to deal with. And our class size task force looked at a few things. First of all, acknowledgement that class size task force was being asked to look at the root contributor to some of these other issues that we care about. And the members that are basically on this was a wide variety of folks, including legislators and administrators and school board members, and also folks that were basically advocates for education in a wide variety of ways. And the task that we were given was really to look at the size and to look at a determination of appropriate class sizes for a variety of different grades, types of curriculum, and also types of students and student needs. And so those were the areas that we looked into. We were also to identify the options to reduce class sizes, and we were to identify the costs associated with the options. And so it's a big deal. It was a big task, and it was a very extensive task, and we really didn't have that long to look at it because we weren't seated until July. The work, we basically had 7 meetings, and we had 6 months basically for the task force to deal with these responsibilities. We heard from parents, we heard from teachers, we heard from education advocates. We also looked at a lot of research all the way back from 1994 all the way up to present time, and some of the different changes in the size of the different classes, both nationally and also in the state of Oregon. We reviewed scholarly studies, we reviewed reports, and we also looked at some of the stories that Oregonians had on this very issue. When you look at the task force numbers and you look at the numbers that we were looking at, we decided to go back to something that we all agreed on. And if you were here during that time of the discussion of the quality education model, then you know that this conversation has been going on for a long time. And we know that we have a quality education model that we have acknowledged. We have class sizes that we've acknowledged as being important and appropriate, but we haven't been able to fund it. And we have a language in that piece of legislation that was passed that basically says either we have to fund it or we have to give a report that tells why we cannot fund it. And even though that sounds like sort of a practical second B plan, it hasn't gotten us any farther along on actually being able to fund the quality education model. So those were some of the things that we thought about when we were looking at some of this work. If you look at the numbers, though, and this is really important, you will see that we're looking at the quality education model numbers that were basically endorsed by the commission that was housed under the Oregon Department of Education. And you can see what those numbers are. The more important numbers, though, are the numbers that are at the bottom of this page. And that is the numbers of the actual averages of classes that are in the state of Oregon. 82% of the classes of the K-1 students are in classes of more than 20 students. 72% of the the second and third students in their classrooms basically is 23. And then we go down, for example, to 75% of the students in fourth and fifth grade have 24 students, and 95% of sixth through eighth grades have at least in their core classes more than 22 students. Those numbers are important because not only are we not meeting the quality education models, but we also we can see that most of the classes are way over or inappropriately over those numbers. The next slide is a number, and I brought this physical copy of the Oregon Rising. This is basically a survey that was taken over 11,000 people in the state of Oregon. And this is a really interesting study that our task force really found to be important because it had all varieties of people in our communities talking about education. It was one of the largest samples that some of the folks that do this surveying for a business said they'd ever seen, and they felt like the document itself had some really interesting data. One of them was that 78% of the Oregon Rising respondents believe that Oregon must lower the class size to achieve quality education for all. Now, that may surprise you when you are thinking about the fact that we've been working on a lot of other things. We've been working on absenteeism. We've been working on making sure we've got good relationships with our students. We've been working on a lot of different issues that we think will improve education in the state of Oregon. But again, what we were discovering from the conversations that we had with people involved with teaching, with parents involved with getting their students appropriate types of educational experiences, that one of the contributing root factors seemed to be class size. So a lot of the five major things that have been worked on by the legislature that we care about, whether it be from safety or absenteeism or dealing with the variety of fragile students that we have or the variety of students with specific needs, that a lot of how you're able to handle those issues really depends on how the teacher is able to cope with the particular size or composition of their classes. We also heard teacher testimony, and the teacher testimony was important. It was really anecdotal, and it was really a situation where we heard a lot of different stories. I'm not going to talk about those today, but they are part of the record and part of the documentation that we have on this task force. The ramification of the large class is extremely important to the results of this particular task force work. And again, you will find listed many of the things that you care about and many of the things that we've tried to work on over the last 10 or 12 years. Relationships between students and teachers and parents and teachers and school and community. Student achievement and graduation rates. Absentee rates. Safety issues with the number of students in a particular classroom. The space, the actual configuration of the classrooms being so crowded that you cannot have a variety of activities that really relate relate to the learning issues and styles of many students. School culture and teacher retention, equity issues, access to classes and electives, all of these things have connections to that basic root configuration of class size. Now, we have a report that is being, it's going through its drafting process, and there are some recommendations that I will go ahead and just highlight for you. And that is that the task force endorses, again, the quality education model standards on class size, that the education in Oregon is chronically underfunded, and that we need to make investments to try and get this quality education model actually funded, and that there is a figure put there, and this is a figure that says $10 billion in 2017-2019. As you all know, there's a $1.9 billion gap between what we're actually funding and the quality education model. And one of the issues that became very, very important, and that was the issue of service level, what it actually takes to provide the service level for education in the state of Oregon. And so what we do know is that whatever the agreed amount upon, and there was a range of costs for service level at present status, and we know that it would take $1.9 billion above that service level of today to actually do it. Now, many of you are probably saying, look, we've got a hard budget year, and you're coming and telling us we need to spend more money on budget. How does that help? How does that help us be able to cope with balancing the budget? Well, this committee was not set up on talking about balancing the budget. This committee was set up, this task force was set up, to actually talk about what is the ramification of class size in the quality education model that we've all agreed to. And it also indicates specifically that we have a gap in actually being able to give the kind of quality education to get to our goals of safety in our classroom, higher graduation rates, dealing with extraordinary and variety of types of experiences for learning. We are going to be actually sending that report out to folks as soon as it's written. We ended up with basically a committee administrator that went on to another task. He may be sitting in the back of the room working for somebody else right now. And so he left our poor committee administrator, Cheyenne, with the task of finishing up our report, and she's doing a bang-up job. But she needs a few more days to help us get through the process of finishing up some of the suggestions for changes in wording on our report. I really appreciate the Senate taking time today to listen to the report on class size and also the connection with the quality education model and with the suggestion that we all continue to try and work on really trying to produce and provide the amount of resources that will allow us to have the quality education model that we all want for all of our students. Every type, every sort, every type of school, we need to support all students in the state of Oregon. Thank you for putting up with that quick little report, but I wanted to make sure I wasn't wasting any of your time on this very long week, right?
Very good.
And I'm here for questions.
Any questions for? No. Well, tell Cheyenne, thank you for helping.
I will. Okay. I will. Thank you.
And we'll touch base with the guy in the back of the room.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Okay. We'll close that informational meeting on class size, and we're going to open an informational meeting on the Oregon Promise. Thank you for our Ben Cannon, Executive Director of Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Thanks for being here. You touched it. She wasn't doing anything.
I got the look. What is he doing? Second from the bottom. There we go. Thank you, Ashley. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for including this update on your agenda. What I'm here to do today is provide preliminary findings from the first term of implementation of the promise. We are doing it, and we have data, including data that started that finished coming in as recently as last Friday, as we get reports from colleges, and we are busy working on our December 31st report to interim legislative committees, including this one, on initial evaluation of the promise. And what you'll see today is essentially a preview of that report that we'll be submitting to you and the other legislative committees related to education before the end of this year. So excited to be here, excited to share some of the work that we've been doing over the last year. So just a little bit of background, and I know this committee is very familiar with the bill, but for reminders, Senate Bill 81 allocated $10 million for this academic year to provide free or near-free community college tuition for eligible students. Eligibility is for up to 90 credits, or the equivalent of 2 full-time years of enrollment. The grants begin at $1,000 per year for some students and up to $3,248 for full-time students. The program was designed to increase college enrollment, completion, and affordability for recent high school and GED graduates. That is an important component of eligibility. As this slide notes, to be eligible for the tuition grant, students have to be recently graduated from high school, have to meet the other eligibility requirements, which include having a 2.5 GPA in high school or its equivalent on the GED, completing a FAFSA, accepting other state and federal awards. There are additional requirements for maintaining the grant once a student has enrolled in community college that ensure satisfactory academic progress, paying a $50 per term copay, and so on. This is a last dollar award. Again, this is not new to this committee, but just as a reminder, it comes in after other state and federal grant funding. Most importantly, the Pell Grant, the federal grant, need-based grant program that supplies much of the tuition reduction for many eligible students, and you'll see more on that in a few minutes, as well as the Oregon Opportunity Grant, our state need-based program. And the Oregon Promise is awarded on top of that and really covers the difference between those awards and the total cost of attendance for the student. This is how it looks for students at different levels of eligibility, which is related to their expected family contribution. So EFC is an acronym that I'll use multiple times. You know it. It is expected family contribution. It is related to family income, although not in a direct way, but I can say a little bit more about that if there are questions. But essentially, this graph, and there are a couple of slides like it, this is a somewhat data-intensive presentation, so be forewarned. This graph demonstrates for lower-income students on the left and higher-income students on the right the way that federal and state and grant funding and then the Oregon Promise are layered in order to support a student's college costs. So students on the left, those lowest-income students, this is on a per-term basis for a full-time student defined as 12 credits, which is the federal Pell Grant definition for full-time. Those lowest-income students would receive the maximum Pell Award of nearly $2,000 for a term. They would receive the maximum Opportunity Grant Award at nearly $700 per term. And then they would receive the minimum Oregon Promise Award, which is that $1,000 annual award prorated for a term. That gets you to $334 minus 50, which is their copay or contribution. So that's how the award structure looks for the lowest income students. For the highest income students, the least needy, those on the right, they receive zero in Pell or Opportunity Grant funding, but receive the larger Oregon Promise Award to bring them up to almost that red line, which is the average tuition at our 17 community colleges. Again, this slide is based on a per term. This is for a single term, which is why these numbers are in the several hundred to $1,000 range rather than the $4,000 or so that a student would pay over the course of a year. We began outreach on this program last fall, not long after the bill was passed. There was an application. There was significant outreach and conversations, events with schools, school districts, GED programs, et cetera. And this is what occurred. So here is our funnel slide. And in the top bar, we've depicted an estimate of the number of 2016 Oregon high school graduates. I want to underscore estimate. We don't have this data yet from ODE, and we won't until the end of January. So we've taken their 2015 numbers and just carried that over into 2016. Of course, we hope there are more graduates in 2016 than there were in 2015, but that's our estimate. And from there, we narrow the filter. So a little over 19,000 applied for the Oregon Promise application, applied for the Promise, went onto our website, filled out that information. But that included people who were not eligible, right? It included people like me who, just to test out the online interface, went in there and tried to fill out an application and was rejected because I'm not a recent high school graduate, not eligible for the promise. So that's the 19,000 applications. Only 13, nearly 14,000 of them met the recent high school or GED and residency requirement. We get down to 10,459 who then went on to submit a FAFSA that listed an Oregon Community College and was accepted, completed by the feds. And then our most recent data is those out of that 10,459, about 1,000 of them enrolled this fall in an Oregon public university, and 6,745 of them enrolled this fall for at least 6 credits in an Oregon community college. So they are our 6,745 Oregon Promise recipients this fall. They have all received at least some funding under the Oregon Promise program. So our key initial kind of research evaluation questions are these. Number one, has the Oregon Promise changed Oregon high school graduates' enrollment patterns in higher education? Is it encouraging enrollment? Number two, who is participating in the Oregon Promise? Who are those 6,745 students? Number three, what will be the cost to the state for implementing the Promise in 2016-17? And I'll address each of these in brief over the next few minutes. So first, what has it meant for enrollment patterns? So this is a very preliminary slide, and there are some caveats around the comparisons here. But what we've done is compared a cohort of 2014 high school completers, so Oregon high school graduates in 2014, with our 2016 high school completers. And you'll see that, again, that estimate for 2016, we've just had to guess at the total number. And then we've gone in the second row here to compare how many of those high school completers from 2014 enrolled in a community college for at least 6 credits without the promise in 2014. And the answer is 5,709 versus 2016, 6,553 enrolled. These two numbers are not precisely comparable, and the notes, these little footnotes, explain why. 2014 includes students who didn't have a high school GPA of 2.5. They would not have qualified for the Oregon Promise. 2016 is just the Oregon Promise students. They have a high school GPA of 2.5. They did a FAFSA. That was not necessarily true 2014. So my guess, and when we get more ODE data and are better able to match the data sets, my guess, my expectation is that the gap, the difference between these numbers, will grow. And so the boost in the percentage of recent high school graduates who enrolled in community college will increase over what's depicted on this slide. We're showing about a 2 percentage point increase here. We think it will likely grow when we're able to get a closer match to the data sets. What has it meant for public universities? So now, this is an estimate, and it's a historic, but it brings it through 2016, of the percentage of recent high school graduates enrolling in an Oregon public university. There are 8 bars on this slide. The top one is all, or 8 lines. The top line is all combined, all 7 public universities combined, and then you see the 7 broken out down below. You'll see that between 2015, no promise, and 2016, Oregon Promise, about a 0.7% drop-off in the number of recent high school graduates enrolling as freshmen in a public university. Again, this is an estimate because of our uncertainty around the Oregon high school graduation data, but we think, you know, probably comes pretty close. That drop of 0.7% is not unprecedented. The same or nearly the same drop occurred between the year 2013 and 14. So I think without more investigation, we're not ready yet to characterize this as being directly attributable to the promise. But it is a notable decline, several hundred students, fewer Oregon high school graduates enrolling in a public university this fall than the previous one. Overall enrollment trends. So now we're talking about the entire higher education, public higher education population in Oregon, including lots of non-Oregon Promise eligible kids, lots of non-recent high school graduates. You'll see on the left-hand side the overall trends at our public universities down. This is the seven individually. There's not a line reflecting the combined, but there is a modest sort of flattening of enrollment at our community colleges or at our public universities over the last four or five years, and then a decline in the community college enrollment, and that top line there is the total fall enrollment at our community colleges. So I thought that was some context for what's occurring generally with enrollment in higher education. Question number two was, who are these students? Who are the 6,745 participating in the Oregon Promise? First thing to note, and suggested from by the last slide, they're a minority of community college students. Just to be very clear, Oregon Promise students, if you walked onto a campus, would represent one in about 20 students on that community college campus. So if you walk on your local community college and start asking randomly, you would expect about one out of 20 would be an Oregon Promise recipient. That's because of the narrow eligibility requirements that were imposed on the program. Here they are by college. Have not done a detailed analysis of this yet. Clearly, there is a relationship between the size of the college and the number of Oregon Promise recipients. No surprise, PCC, the largest, Chemeketa is up there as well. Our smaller community colleges, smaller numbers of students. But again, we've not done a more detailed, in-depth analysis of how this stacks up with total enrollment or the population of the regions they serve, but generally it seems to reflect the relationship that we would expect, but more to come on that. If you're looking for Oregon Coast Community College, Senator Roblin, its numbers are included within Portland Community College because of the way that financial aid works for those students, so they get reported within those PCC numbers. A few more data slides about those students who enrolled, got a grant through the Oregon Promise. So this now looks at them by income or by their eligibility for the Pell Grant. The left-hand slide, or the left-hand bar, 25% of our Oregon Promise recipients received a full Pell Grant this fall. And on the right-hand side, 53.3% received no Pell Grant. So those are more affluent students on the right, less affluent on the left. Those middle two bars, they received some Pell Grant. So essentially, you know, a sort of sliding scale on the grant related to expected family contribution or family income. By race, ethnicity, what we've done here is compare our Oregon Promise recipients this fall with their high school graduating class by race, ethnicity. This is not yet final. We need a little better breakdown of the ODE numbers. You can see there's an unknown category here that applies just to the Promise recipients, but not the ODE. So work to come still on this. But you see that the Oregon Promise class is diverse. But there are some non-trivial differences between for certain subpopulations. So particularly the first two race ethnicity categories, African-American or Black and American Indian and Alaska Native students, are under-enrolled in the Oregon Promise relative to their proportion of the class, most recent class of 12th graders. There's interest in dual credit, of course, and there's further research work to come on this, but we were able to quickly look at how many of our 6,745 Oregon Promise students this fall were enrolled in a community college as juniors or seniors through dual credit programs, and you'll see here a pretty significant number, nearly 30% had community college credit as a junior and almost 40% as a high school senior. Finally, key question number three, for the kind of first time since the program was considered and we were providing estimates to this committee and others about the cost of the promise, we now have some actual data from the fall term and our implementation. I'm going to give you a full year projection for 16-17, but it carries some assumptions that I want to be sure to describe. It assumes that we retain the Oregon Promise students at what we believe to be a historic sort of average, so that term-to-term retention is about 82%, which is what it appears to be for recent high school graduates. And it assumes that the new enrollment in the Promise for the duration of this academic year is negligible. There will be December graduates from high school who will qualify for the Promise and begin the Promise in winter or spring, but those numbers we expect to be small. Using the fall data of that we now project that total state costs for Oregon Promise Awards for 2016-17 would be $10.9 million, which exceeds the $10 million appropriation for this program. So we will be working further with this data and disbursements over the next several weeks in order to refine this analysis. And if necessary, present you and other legislators with a plan and proposal for how to make this work for the remainder of the 2016-17 year. But you can see here, we expect to disperse about $4.4 million in awards this fall. When we apply that 82% rate, we get the $3.6 million for winter and $2.9 million for spring. It's the first year of a program that we had no direct experience in implementing. So we actually feel like this 10.9 comes remarkably close to the legislature's appropriation of 10 million, but it does create a potential funding gap within this biennium. This sort of goes back to the question of who are these students and how are they funded. This slide, I think it's just the question was raised during the legislative debate about need and where state dollars go. And you understand that built into a last dollar program is the assumption that more state dollars get applied to students who are less eligible for federal awards. And that's really what this slide reflects. If you lined up all 6,745 students from the lowest income to the highest income and divided that line into fifths, that's what you'd see here. So that first fifth of lowest income students, $0 EFC students, will receive, under these projections, about $1 million in state Oregon Promise funding for this academic year, or 7.8% of the total. The uppermost quintile, the uppermost fifth, with EFCs starting at about $19,645, would receive about $4 million in state funding this academic year, or about 30% of the total. EFC is not a sort of way we're used to thinking about income, except in higher ed. And it doesn't directly translate to income. That's the way the FAFSA takes into account number of dependents, assets of certain types, number of kids in college, et cetera. But just so the public can sort of get some sense of this, if you go online and try to make the conversion, a family with two dependents, let's say sort of average assets, a $19,000 or $20,000 expected family contribution. So that uppermost quintile, that would be a two-dependent family. That might be roughly $110,000 annual adjusted gross income. So that's a sense there. And then we're talking about at the $2,000 or $3,000 EFC level, that's in the sort of $30,000 to $40,000 adjusted gross income, again, two-dependent household. So this is just a summary of findings. I know you're short on time. I won't read through the slide, but we see a larger percentage of community colleges, a larger percentage of recent high school graduates enrolling in community college, slightly smaller percentage enrolling in universities. We need more data to understand that and validate it. We see that it's a last dollar program, so more state funding goes to recipients with higher income, but that the proportion of students with lower Pell eligible versus non and Pell eligible roughly mirrors the community college population 50-50. And you see the total participation and cost for fall 2016. These are some of the additional questions that we will be attempting to answer over the next weeks and months as we provide continuing feedback and evaluation to you on implementation of the Promise in the first year. And as I conclude, I want to just note the really extraordinary effort that many around the state have gone to make this program work and I think be successful in its first year, including the staff of my agency, its Office of Student Access and Completion, which have built from scratch a new state scholarship program, a national model, really the only the second in the country that's been attempted on a statewide basis. And while it has not been error-free or without occasional hitches, it's been remarkably smooth in the implementation, and that owes a lot of that owes to the hard work and creativity and dedication of our staff.
Thank you very much. And we have at least one question for you from the great senator from nearby Albany area and
Sarah Gelser.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Have you looked at, in terms of the cost, what the fiscal impact would be and the equity impact in terms of the students that are enrolling if the minimum GPA was dropped from 2.5 to 2.0? And the reason that I ask that is that, I mean, I understand we had to make choices to be able to get this off the ground. What I'm starting to hear from kids is the idea that if I don't have a 2.5 grade point average, I should give up on any idea of going to college because I'm not college material. And I don't think that's what anybody intended, and it's certainly not true. So I'm wondering, what would it cost for us to fix that problem?
Senator Gelser, Chair Roblin, it's a great question. We too have heard that concern, and our commission shares it. We do not know the cost impact, in part because the state doesn't collect high school GPA data. We are collecting it now for these students, but we don't yet have a great sense of what additional proportion of that high school graduating class would be eligible when you go from 2.5 to 2 or 1.5 or 1.8 or whatever that number is. We'll be working with school districts, assuming that proposal comes forward during the legislative session, to try to get a handle on it. It would cost more. There's no question. It would make more students eligible. How many more students? We can't say today.
And then two other follow-up questions. And Senator Haas, welcome to you as well. I had shared with you one of my constituents, and I know that I've had others, where their grade point average dropped after their application and their award, but they weren't notified that that award wasn't available. So they enrolled in school, they have the grant for the fall, and the grant is being revoked from them because their final GPA was like 2.49 or 2.48. Do you have a sense of how many of those students there are? And then the second question is, I think a lot of us have heard from the FFA kind of students that are part of a career and technical education leadership program that does not allow them to be formally enrolled. Are there other types of situations like that where there might be a deferred enrollment that the HEC is looking at, or others to accommodate?
Senator Gelser, Chair Roblin, great questions. So on the first issue, there are several dozen students who were improperly notified of their eligibility to receive an award. They did not satisfy the 2.5 GPA requirement, or did not prove that they had satisfied the 2.5 GPA requirement, and yet they were awarded a fall award. We chose not to revoke that fall award. So students in that category, several dozen of them, I don't have the precise number, but we can follow up. Students in that category received their fall award. However, under the law, we believe that we cannot knowingly award those students winter and spring awards. And as a result, we've notified those students and did so as soon as we realized the mistake that they were not eligible to receive winter and spring awards. And so that, again, that's the category of student who I think you're referring, and there were several dozen in the state. Your other question was about students who are, for whatever reason, doing something else after high school or are unable to immediately enroll in community college and therefore would be eligible but are not because of that delayed enrollment. And we have heard those stories, including from the FFA students. And again, the law is very inflexible in this regard, just as it is around GPA. Students have to have enrolled in community college within a year of graduating high school for the first year, of the program, and starting really now, it's a 6-month window of enrollment. So we see no way under the current law to provide any flexibility. And we've heard stories, I mean, students who are caring for a sick parent, right, or there's been some sort of tragedy in their family that makes it impossible for them to enroll this fall. And we have had to say to them, as we've had to say to the FFA students, that the law is inflexible in this regard. But certainly, if the legislature were to bring forward a proposal to provide some flexibility to the agency to grant waivers around that or any other provision, we would be happy to work with you on seeing that through.
And I forgot one other element to the grade point average. So on that couple dozen kids, do you know, is there anything that we can do for that handful that were, I mean, as we adjusted that postgraduate scholar program, in order to participate in that postgraduate scholar, the old fifth-year program, you had to apply for Oregon Promise. If you received a grant award letter from Oregon Promise, you weren't eligible for the postgraduate scholar program. And you're not eligible for the postgraduate scholar program unless you immediately enroll in the fall. Is there anything that can be done for these kids, because they were following the law as set up in order to access post-secondary, but because of an error that we made are now ineligible for both?
Senator Gelser, Chair Roberlin, it sounds like a cruel double bind to put a student in, and we would be, I have not explored that, the implications for the postgraduate scholar program, but if, as you described, because of our error in, you know, awarding them the fall award, essentially that was the mistake we made, was we told them they would get the fall award, they are not only, you know, cut off from the Oregon Promise, but then not able to participate in the postgraduate scholar program, I would certainly want to work with the legislature, or if we can do it at the agency level, find some other way to support those students.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Hess.
I would very much support lowering the GPA to 2.0, but knowing that the cost will rise if we do that. And for that matter, you know, increasing it wherever, you know, dislocated workers. That was a really data-dense presentation. It has great insights. And not that I would expect anything less from you, Director Cannon, but it was really, really insightful. Data and numbers and charts, however, don't always tell all of the story. And I was just wondering if you could characterize, you know, to what extent have you seen a culture change with this?
Senator Hess, Chair Roblin, yes, it's a good question. So in addition to this quantitative work, this data-driven work, we've also partnered with Education Northwest over the last year, and it has done focus groups and student surveys. It's talked to counselors and teachers. And so we will bring to bear in our evaluation and in my comments now, not only our own anecdotal, if you will, experiences with students and families in the program, but also the thousands of students who they surveyed in an open-ended sort of way, and the focus groups that they conducted. And the response to the program has been extraordinary. It's been positive. There has been, we've heard just tremendous appreciation for it. It appears, again, from the sort of testimony and responses of high school counselors and the students themselves, it appears to, in some schools, maybe many schools, really galvanized the sense that students can be college going, that college is possible. I want to be careful not to sort of overstate it, but I believe it has had a real effect on Oregonian high school students' ability to see themselves as college going, and that college can be affordable. And I think that's very, very exciting.
Other questions? I guess the one thing I would say as well is looking at those numbers, and I appreciate that dense numbers, commendation to Senator Hess in the fact that we only had a limited amount of money. There was very little money to implement this program. And by the looks of the money, we're going to get right there. We're going to spend all the money, but not much over. And that's pretty hard to predict. So I am really pretty impressed with that. So thank you for that, too. Any other questions? Thanks. So You can stay up there because you get to be in the next group as well, and I will close our informational hearing on the Oregon Promise, and we're going to open an informational hearing on Campus Safety Work Group. And we'll have Andrea LeDuc, Ben Cannon, and Superintendent Travis Hampton from Oregon State Police. Thank you for being here.
Chair Roblin, as colleagues are getting settled, my portion of this is very brief, so let me get it out of the way. I'm Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and here really just to express my gratitude to be able to participate in the Campus Safety Work Group. The HEC helped to staff and support it. We worked with the governor's office to make the appointments to the work group, but we were largely in a supportive role, and I'm very grateful not only for the partnership with Oregon State Police and law enforcement, but also with Andre LeDuc from the University of Oregon, who chaired the council. He and his team at the U of O did yeoman's work to put together the report and recommendations, and we look very much to working with him, the rest of the group, with OSP, and with all of you on implementing at least some of these recommendations.
Thank you. I'll try to be even briefer to get to the meat of the conversation. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Travis Hampton. I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Police and also a member of the governor's campus safety work group. I just wanted to speak to the process, the level of cooperation and collaboration with our colleagues in higher education, campus public safety. Law enforcement had a seat at the table through every aspect of our process through our work group. I think the recommendations are meaningful, they're thoughtful, they're sustainable. And just from a law enforcement perspective, I just wanted to come here today to support the recommendations and the process, both as a career state trooper, but also on a personal note, as a father of two daughters attending and living on college campus in Oregon. I think these recommendations are once again thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your consideration. With that, I'll pass the baton to my colleague. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Roblin and committee members, thank you for inviting me to come up and present with my colleagues the findings that we have from the Campus Safety Work Group. It has been an interesting 8 months. The work, I think, was really predicated, all of us, had some role in the tragedy at the Umpqua Community College. And I think that the work that this work group put together as far as how do we chart a path forward and really developing kind of a framework to move forward so that all post-secondary institutions can work together to make safer and more resilient campuses. And so that's what I'll be sharing with you today. The governor had, convened all the presidents from post-secondary institutions earlier this year and kind of charged this work group that we're talking about, and I'll give you some oversight on. And really the charge had twofold to it. One was to ask us as post-secondary institutions and our state partners, ways that we could ensure best practices or promising practices as it relates to responding, preparing for, recovering, and kind of getting campuses back online of, were we effectively managing that, and were there ways that we could just, through information sharing and best practices, share that with other institutions. The other was to identify resource needs at the campus level that potential state policy changes could be pushed forward to, again, improve all. And I think this is the one thing that you'll see throughout this. We're talking all post-secondary institutions. And so the participation was public, private, two-year, 4 year. So we really did take this charge to heart and looked at, we did not want this to be looking at one hazard, but to look holistically on how do we make our campuses safer and more resilient to anything that they could face. Again, we had a large working group, 27 members. We were convened at the end of March and we're meeting monthly. We then broke into subgroups. We were fortunate enough to capitalize on actually the audience that we're trying to protect, our students, and empowering them to help us. So we actually had a graduate student team working with us over the summer to do survey work, stakeholder interviews, to again try to compile all this. What we didn't want to do is process this to the point where we were in a work group for 2 years trying to figure out what to do. And so we set very tight timelines. And what we have today to present, I think, is a very, very thorough report. And again, a report that sets out a framework of how to address these issues and how to start now. And so in that, there really are five core recommendations that the working group came up with. that look at everything from how do we establish some type of council that oversees safety and resilience on campus, again, cutting across to the various different institutional boundaries that might exist, again, public, private, two-year, four-year, looking at then response coordination, continuity, public safety, law enforcement, physical security and infrastructure, and behavioral threat assessment. And I'm going to quickly run you through kind of the high levels of our findings. The first, and actually the way that we presented this, and at the end of the slide deck, I'll show you, we actually developed a poster to kind of show how we see kind of rolling this out, that our first recommendation is also our most critical one, of establishing some type of body or council that is charged to look at this. Meaning the work group was very dedicated and threw energy and time at getting us to this point. The concern is that we don't want to see this kind of just hang there and be a report that doesn't go anywhere. And so establishing some type of council that has connection to the governor's office, to the state agencies and state agency leadership, so that there's connection and there's ownership around these issues, so that we can use the recommendations that we've set forth in this report as a roadmap to move forward. And again, the idea would be the council is not only reaching up into the state and kind of conveying information, but also reaching out across the state and working with all of those post-secondary institutions to make sure that they have a voice and are focused on the mission at hand. Our next set of recommendations, and kind of we follow these a little bit in order, are looking at our response, continuity, and recovery capabilities. And in that, one of the first recommendations that we've set there is to standardize training, meaning there's a lot of opportunity of scale in the sense of developing trainings that we can rotate around the state and make sure that all institutions are training at the same level around response, continuity, and recovery. And in higher education, there's some unique differences to our folks that work on the municipal side in the sense that often after the incident is over or after the fire's put out or after the power failure, that's actually when the work starts on how do you reboot the campus and how do you get things going again. And that's what leads into our action item number 2.2, which is the concept of developing incident management teams that could cover all of the state. So right now, the University of Oregon is one of the only universities that has a Type 3 FEMA-recognized incident management team. So we're no different than any other Type 3 incident management team. The part that's unique is we are pulling from people that work in a higher education environment. So if there is a crisis, we're able to navigate things like financial aid, understand the complexities of a campus environment, of kind of rebooting them. And that was one of the things we were able to help with when we went down and deployed to the Umpqua Community College. And so this is one I know we're very passionate about, that looking at in a 2 to 3 year timeline, how do we make sure that we have coverage throughout the state so that if something bad happens at an educational institution, there's a group that can connect with the first responders and take them to that next step, which would be the continuity and recovery aspect. The other component that we've been working on in Oregon, but actually has a national component, is there is now a national intercollegiate mutual aid agreement that allows higher education institutions to enter into a mutual aid agreement similar to what law enforcement and fire services have done for years. The uniqueness of this is if we have a very specialized need at, say, OSU or the U of O, we can share those resources within the state. But this is a national mutual aid agreement that we're just now rolling out across the country that we could draw upon resources from MIT, Florida State University, Cornell. So again, that idea of not thinking small, but actually thinking how do you scale? The other components underneath response, continuity, and recovery are, again, focused on training and capacity building across the state and thinking about earthquake preparedness, thinking about other risks that instead of having each campus try and reinvent the wheel, but looking at how can we develop preparedness material that can be shared broadly. So that any institution, so if one institution develops a really innovative way on doing outreach and awareness, whether that's around active shooter events or acts of violence or earthquake, that we have a means and a mechanism to share that so other institutions can jump onto that and use that. The other part that would be useful in this is as our students matriculate from campus to campus, which we know that happens between our two-year schools and our four-year schools, the safety and security messages are relatively the same. So the idea of there's transferability. Moving over to the public safety and law enforcement side, one of the recommendations, the first recommendation we had out there is working with our partners at DPSST around training for public safety officers, so looking at how we can enhance that. Recommendation 3.2 is making sure that all post-secondary institutions have access to sworn law enforcement, and again, that can either be through MOUs, mutual a memorandum of understanding, or some type of agreement. And again, to address the nuances that we face in a higher education environment, including things like the Clery Act, Title IX. So it's making sure that those institutions have that access. And again, through mutual aid, if one campus has an officer that is skilled in doing certain types of investigations, we can start building those bridges and connections that we might be able to loan officer from one campus to another campus, or work with state police to get an officer that knows that. And again, we've had already preliminary discussions with DPSST around what we're doing in the basic academy to make sure that officers coming out of the academy, because the majority of our campuses are covered by the local law enforcement, to make sure that they have situational awareness on the federal requirements as it relates to higher education. The other component that we put in there is we have a limiting factor right now in the inability to hire retired law enforcement because of some of the PERS implications. And where that becomes a bit of a challenge is when we're looking for seasoned detectives or folks that could actually do the investigatory side, a lot of campuses that now have law enforcement, whether that's OHSU, OSU, PSU, U of O, we're actually forced to look out of state to get some of those seasoned folks because of those limitations. And so one of the recommendations we have there is we actually do have underneath ORS 238.082 an exemption for places like Sun River, Black Butte, so smaller jurisdictions, and we're putting in a request there on a legislative fix to add higher education to the exemption, but to put a gatekeeper on that should never exceed more than 25% of a campus's force. But the part that we don't want to exclude, having seasoned Oregon law enforcement officials that could be working at our campuses in a full-time capacity, even if they've retired of 25 years service. So the other part, of course, is, again, continuing to work on how we do training with all law enforcement partners for acts of violence on campus, whether that be active shooter or any type of assailant. The physical security, again, this is a component that right now we're kind of all across the board as far as the various institutions and what they have for physical security, whether that be doors, cameras, AMAG systems. And so our first recommendation is to make sure that all institutions, we're suggesting they should have a campus security standard. So when they're building new structures or renovating, that they have a standard that they're following. And again, there are national standards that they can use around crime prevention through environmental design. And so again, making a very strong statement that you should have that. At the 4.2 recommendation, we're proposing a physical security grant program and funding for the existing resources. So when we're developing new buildings on campus, it's easy to incorporate those standards if you have them and put that to the project cost. The bigger challenge is on existing buildings that are out there and trying to find the funding to put in a new AMAG or access control system or camera systems. And so we would want to make sure that is very specific, that that grant program would be focused on what needs are around existing facilities. One of the activities we did as a work group was polling all of the two-year and four-year schools on what their physical security needs were. And again, the intent was we wanted to find out how big of a ask this could be. And what we found is it's actually somewhere in the 20 to 30 million. We had thought that it could actually be higher. But again, a lot of campuses are making progressive moves towards trying to get better security systems on their campus. But it's really some of those older buildings that there's no identified funding source for them to go after. And so that's why we're proposing the grant program. And we are suggesting modeling it after the seismic rehabilitation grant program that the state already has, in the sense of how that would be funded. The other opportunity a theme that goes throughout this is getting campuses connected and working together. So looking at ways that we might be able to establish purchasing cooperatives that other smaller campuses might be able to jump onto as far as purchasing things things around lighting or access control or cameras. Again, trying to standardize some of the security systems without actually standardizing it by actually using the purchasing power that we would have throughout the state. And then the fourth recommendation there, again, getting facilities folks together on a regular basis to share promising practices so that we're making a network and a community that is focused on making our campuses safer. The final set of recommendations were related to behavioral threat assessment and prevention. And this one falls very much in line with what the K through 12 task force, campus safety task force, put together around looking at threat assessments. And so these are behavioral threat assessments. So looking at when we may have individuals either on campus or in the community that could pose a threat to campus, of making sure that we have teams on the campuses that know how to evaluate those threats, that they have, again, standardized training throughout the state so they can lean on each other, developing self-audit tools and in the sense to see, are we doing what we need to be doing on a campus in comparison to what other campuses are having? And then the bottom line on this one is looking at, you know, again, we would be coordinating with the K through 12 task force on this, in the sense that the students that are coming from the K through 12 system are then matriculating up into our campus. So making sure that those systems are in alignment. And again, the work group supports the initiatives that the K through 12 task force is already working on. And so this is not a vision test, but again, you can download this. So we did put this in a poster, and one of the reasons that we wanted to put this in a poster and share that with both this committee or any other committee is that what we didn't want people to get lost in is we do have a very comprehensive plan that's, you know, a 50-page plan, but then the addendums, we get over 200 pages. The poster tells you everything you need to know, that what we're looking at is we can move this ball forward by, again, establishing a council and then starting to look at funding streams where we can start doing the training and outreach across campuses. And one of the initiatives that we put forth is the concept of funding a three-year, one-time training consortium that would be going around the state working with all higher education institutions to basically launch this. And they would be simultaneously taking a number of the recommendations that I just quickly went over today and moving them all forward so that we can increase the standard but also the capacity across the state. So with that, I'll open up if there are questions.
Any questions for this group? I just want to say thank you to all of you, and thank you for a very clear and concise presentation. That was really important. I'm going to look at the chart, but it does give us, I think, a pretty clear pathway to implement strategies that can make campuses safer. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So we'll close our informational session on higher ed safety, and we'll open an informational meeting on the Chief Education Office. Save the best for last, Lindsay, I guess that's the way it goes. And you have a new person with you. Who could this possibly be? Oh.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lindsay Capps. I'm the Chief Education Officer. And as things go between the executive and legislative branch, we'll only be taking about an hour of your time.
Okay, that's nice.
Actually, we'll try to keep this brief, knowing that we'll have the opportunity to, hopefully at your invitation, come back and talk a little bit more about the topics that we'll outline today. So I wanted just to speak to you all in part on the governor's behalf around sort of two priorities that are based in what she has outlined in 2016 for improving our high school graduation rates in this state. One part of that, of course, is the establishment of a education innovation officer within the Chief Education Office to put a spotlight on how we improve graduation outcomes. The other is the Council for Educator Advancement, in which the chair of this committee actually served. So we wanted to get to those two topics today to sort of frame a little bit both pieces of work that really, I think, go together in terms of how we comprehensively address graduation outcomes in Oregon. So I'll start by introducing someone that I know that many of you know, but Colt Gill, as our education innovation officer, and obviously his critical charge around graduation comes with, I think, a theory of action that we think is particularly important, which is connecting with communities to identify those strategies and practices and frankly programs that we know work, and then how do we then support those efforts at the local level and also think about how we scale those efforts given that they're effective with the students that we know are most in need of that support. So with that, I will turn it over to Colt to talk a little bit about the engagement that's already happened through the Chief Education Office with communities around the state and share some of the themes that have emerged through that engagement.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to begin to share our effort around improving graduation outcomes for Oregon's kids. For the record, my name is Colt Gill, Education Innovation Officer. Governor Brown is prioritizing graduation improvements by setting a vision that every student graduates with a plan for their future. And you all know this, but we have a long way to go to get to this goal. Right now, after spending 13 years in our school systems from kindergarten through 12th grade, 26% of our students are not able to graduate on time. Oregon is the third worst performing state in the nation on that metric and about 9 points off the national average. In 2015, our poor performance with on-time graduation meant that 11,826 of our students didn't graduate on time. These rates are disproportionately impact students with disabilities, students of color, students living in tribal communities, and students navigating poverty, and our boys. Governor Brown was very clear also when those rates came out that our graduation rate is unacceptable and is not keeping with the gains made in other states. To ensure a better future for our children and our state, we must change our practices and find ways to innovate. So in this new role that I'm in as the Education Innovation Officer at the Chief Education Office, I work across our preschool to higher education systems and focus on improving graduation outcomes. I'll be coordinating closely with the Chief Education Officer and the Deputy Superintendent to guide the governor's priorities and implementation strategies related to graduation. I have been and will continue to engage with schools and communities and researchers to identify what's working and consider how we can take successful practices and partnership models to all corners of the state. I'll recommend policy and budget priorities to improve graduation rates to ensure that our students have a meaningful future opportunity, and I consider how those kinds of policies can be implemented through practice in the field. So this summer and fall, I worked with a researcher from the Chief Education Office to visit with diverse communities across Oregon. We asked them pretty directly what was derailing their children on their path to graduation and what local programs they thought were making a difference. We were able to talk with students and families, business leaders, community partners, healthcare providers, community housing providers, tribal leaders, educators, and many other kinds of folks. And all we met face-to-face with about 1,000 individuals representing dozens of communities across 32 counties in Oregon. The meetings became very real at times. The people that were there were open and honest with us. There were laughs at times. There was a lot of pride, both in the place where they worked and lived and in the programs they were providing. But there were also quite a few tears over students who were being lost in our systems and in our communities. Across the state, there was great alignment in what communities recommended we focus on, and there was great diversity in describing how initiatives should be implemented in different places across our state. Participants coalesced around a strong emphasis on equity, recognizing that Oregon is changing and our systems of support have not kept up with our rapidly diversifying communities. They also focused on making time for developing relationships between caring adults and students, and also demonstrating relevance of programs to students and to local goals and infrastructure. Participants got pretty specific as well. They identified 10 initiatives that they thought could make a difference for students and change the trajectory of our graduation outcomes. My hope is that we can come back when it gets closer to the session and to deliver the full report to you. It'll have quotes from participants across Oregon, and we'll be able to share directly with you some of those initiatives and some ideas about how we can turn a few of those into policy and implement them as practices across our districts and communities in Oregon. So for now, I'll just say thanks, and hope to connect with you again in January or February.
I would just say thank you for taking on this challenge. I have enjoyed watching your successes in your previous engagements, and I look forward to working with you here. Thank you, Cole.
Thank you, Chair Robin.
Okay.
So the second area we wanted just to briefly touch on today was the Council for Educator Advancement. I think all of you have been provided with a report with the recommendations that have been developed through that body, which was established by executive order and began work about 7 months ago. It's been a really tremendous group of individuals to work with, representing not only teachers and school administrators, but school district and community leadership. And they have provided us, both the governor and the legislative body and state agencies, with about 10 recommendations on how we can improve comprehensive supports for our educators across the state. One of the, I think, the key philosophies that was not only reflected in the governor's executive order, but also reaffirmed by the council itself, was how we better leverage the expertise of exemplary teachers and school leaders across our state. And part of that begins with our ability to better coordinate supports for educators and think about how we develop more efficient networks where expertise can be shared. There were basically four themes that I think framed the council's deliberations. The first theme was really around equity and the council's commitment to closing educational opportunity gaps for all students, and understanding that every educator really should be prepared and supported in creating welcoming and inclusive environments for our students, should engage students and families, and help overall efforts to address systemic barriers to learning. So one of the key recommendations that they've made in that realm is really ensuring that we align our state and federal funding for professional learning to professional development, leadership development that's equity driven, that's designed with practitioner involvement, that's grounded in the context in which practice is happening, and that we help to enforce that through state adopted standards that reinforce equity and cultural responsiveness. The second theme that guided the work of the council was ensuring that there's time to support professional learning. And the way in which we organize that professional learning cannot be sort of one-stop, drive-in professional development, but really sustained and job-embedded over time. And that's a critical piece of their recommendations. And so one of the ways in which we can do that effectively is, one, ensuring that models that allow for collaboration between teachers and administrators to really design their own professional learning is critical. And we also have to find ways of supporting our new teachers, our novice educators, our novice school administrators with mentoring and coaching over the first 2 years of their career. The third theme that the council really talked through and guided their work is empowering teacher voice and leadership, and I think in two really critical ways. The first is really to create opportunities for teacher leaders to be engaged in informing and enhancing teaching and learning, and to be involved in building the capacity across all educators to really be involved and engaged in improving student learning. The second is to empower the voices of classroom teachers really in decision making, not only at the classroom level, but at the district and to some degree at the state level, so that policies that are impacting teaching and learning have their voice and engagement. The fourth and final theme that the council really organized themselves around is reflecting a seamless system in the work that we do to support educators. So some of that is bringing sectors together, teacher preparation programs, and our pre-kindergarten services, our school districts, community colleges, and universities to promote interest in the profession, to bring people and especially a diverse workforce into teaching, whether that's in the early learning context or in the K-12 system, and to be more coordinated between preparation and in-service in terms of how we're preparing educators to step into these roles. And the second and more probably more important piece for the purposes of this legislature, and it goes back to the original call for this group to come together, is to figure out a way in which we move away from a competitive model of funding professional learning around the state to really empowering regionalization and the delivery of professional learning that is guided by local context, so that we are more adept at both funding professional learning that is guided by administrators and teachers and aligned to the needs within specific regions of the state and communities in the state, but also think about ways in which we can more flexibly provide this these resources over time, so that we're not looking from a biennial to biennial sort of process of funding, but thinking about how we can sustain professional learning and continuous improvement efforts over the long term, much more aligned to the time frame in which that work happens. So it's something that we will talk more about as we get into the session, and with the hope that we'll be invited back to present that. We are working across state agencies at the moment to really think about how we can implement these recommendations. We'll be working with the council to share some of our thinking about how we might leverage public and nonprofit partnership to bring about this new system, and certainly to be able to come back to the legislature and articulate both a vision and a plan of action for all of you to consider. So thank you so much for the time today. We really appreciate it.
Questions? I just want to commend the whole work group and all the people that were on it, and the commitment made by many organizations, you know, from administrators to teachers to Chalkboard Project. I mean, the list goes on. There are a lot of people in our state and a lot of organizations in our state that really do care about improving education, and most of them have come to the conclusion that the best way to do that is through teachers. The better the teacher is in the classroom, the more likely it is that students will learn. The more trained that teacher is with respect to equity issues, the more likely those kids in her class, his or her classroom, are going to be treated in a way that's equitably correct. And you know, looking at some of the statistics on national certification, I wasn't always, when it first happened, didn't know that that was really the right way to go, because I thought we could do a lot of the stuff ourselves. I still think we can do a lot of ourselves, and I think that that was clear in this work group. But evidence from places like State of Washington and others have shown that investments in those and getting a cadre of those teachers working together can really help change the whole feeling about what it is to be a professional educator in communities around the state. But it takes a group of them to get to that point. And, you know, we have seen that a group forming. They've come to a number of my other committees, send people from this professional group that have been nationally certified. I hope we can continue to support and find ways to help that happen. We've had regional types of solutions to do that. But this is the first time I think we've comprehensively tried to bring all those groups together to come up with a plan, and I hope we can figure out how to implement this over the next few weeks, months, and days. So you will be invited back, and I am really pleased that there's a lot of people were wondering, what would we do with an innovation officer? You have to know that there were lots of people who said, what in the world does that even mean? So having it start to solidify around graduation requirements and getting kids to graduate, I think was a really good start. It may morph into other things if we get that on the right track, and so that we could do some other things, but I don't think they could have found a better capable person to do that. So thank you both for being here. And with that, we'll close that our public hearing on the education office. And Any good of the orders from anyone? I want to thank you for hanging in there. We had a long agenda. There's a lot of stuff that's been happening in the interim, and I thought we should at least get a briefing on most of that stuff. And I appreciate all the people who have come to give us updates. We'll have more of it to go as we get into the session, but thank you very much.
I've got a five-minute break before my next 2 hours starts.
So we're going to adjourn our education committee meeting today.